It looks like it now matches the corner radius of a Mac laptop screen. So if that's true, because if not, it's very close. But if that's true, that makes some sense.
You know what the corner radius does not match?
The XDR?
No. The radius of the toolbar buttons. Concentricity
right.
is dead, baby. Oh it does God. Not. It does not.
That's
like when the
why
toolbar,
they did it. Oh, wow.
Because that's what, when you had a toolbar and like they had the rounded corners, the concentricity. It was the whole idea of like, it, you know, if you draw, you can make a central point and then draw the radius and that will be the edge of the toolbar button. And then you keep going out farther and that is the radius. That is the edge of the window. And I think it's fine mostly, but like this is one of the cornerstones of their making everything sort of capsule shaped with like semicircular corners. And to make that look nice, it's like, well, we need to have that radius, you know, as you go farther from the button, the radius of, you know, it needs to match. Concentricity is what they called it, right? And if you have, you know, rectilinear toolbar buttons, you don't have that problem, but they don't. So they kept the liquid glass semicircular end cap toolbar buttons, but they also made every window have the same corner radius on the Mac and that corner radius be smaller, which means that it no longer matches the toolbar radius. And so I'm sure Alan Dye hates it. And when I look at it, I see it's slightly less harmonious, but I don't care because practically speaking, I want to see more of my content. I don't want 17 different corner radiuses on my Windows and my Mac.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of any design is you have like the theory, the principles and the theories that you're trying to achieve, but then at some point, reality has a conflict with those. There's some trade-off you have to make where you have to sacrifice some of the purity of your goals and principles for just pragmatic reasons, or there's some conflict somewhere that arises.
Or you have to think that this goal I was trying to achieve was not a good goal.
Well, right.
Because the goal of concentricity is, it looks nice and it is visually geometrically pleasing. But what is the purpose of Windows? What is the purpose of a user interface? The purpose of Windows and a user interface is to present content and controls so people can use software. The purpose is not to look amazing in screenshots and for you to be able to draw little circles on stuff and say, look how the corner radius is. It has a job. Design is how it works. And so if you say like, oh, I have to compromise my design. Well, remind me again why you were so dead set on these semicircular end caps on toolbar buttons. They waste space and they don't look good unless you overly round the corners. And so we say, oh, you have to back off from your purity of design. Your design was not to an end that was benefiting the user. It was benefiting you because it made you feel good in screenshots. But that doesn't benefit the user. So thank God they've backed that out. And now they have this awkward design where they kept the toolbar buttons because it's hard to change them that radically. You're not going to make everything square edge at this point. But they fixed the windows. So now they have this hodgepodge where it no longer looks good. We're still wasting a little bit of space in toolbar buttons. But at least they've gone in a pragmatic direction. It seems every change they've made, it seems to me that whoever used to be there, who is not letting them make this obvious change, is now gone or has changed their mind.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is a Stephen LeMay thing. Maybe it was getting rid of Alan Dye thing. Maybe it's somebody else. But whoever, yeah, whatever.
Maybe it's because one half like now is winning the argument with the like the court of public opinion swaying the inside people. Okay, well, we agree. We were wrong to try that. Let's back it off a little bit. But we still have to wait 3 or 4 more years for them to do a new design that is actually both internally harmonious and actually designed well and useful for its purpose.
Yeah, I mean, what we have here is, you know, on the Mac, what we have is something that has been edited. Again, it's like a 1.1. It has been tweaked. The tweaks that they have made are largely good, but the foundations of it are still weird and not really fitting in the platform as well as they could. But that being said, I did one of the things I noticed, like in my first few minutes of poking around on Golden Gate on my laptop. One of the first things I noticed was this new button style, like where it's like a little bit like glossier, a little more polished. There's like there's a border around some of the buttons. It actually looks a little bit like they're reinventing Aqua. Like it's a newer, you know, plainer version of Aqua. It's the Crystal Pepsi version of Aqua, but it is getting closer to Aqua. The buttons that they have now, the tweak to that is not subtle. You won't like the if you out there haven't seen Golden Gate yet, the minute you start using it, you're going to notice, wow, the buttons are really like the toolbar buttons and all the windows really stand out now in a way they didn't before. And it almost like it looks a little out of place. It looks kind of like, all right, the toolbar buttons before, we wanted to show off our glassiness so well that we made them too glassy and then nobody could really see anything. Now, the problem was nobody could see them well enough. So we took our glass and just turned it up. Like, we made it louder in the interface, like visually louder. And so what we have now is now the toolbar buttons are like a little bit too, like they stand out a little bit too much now.
Yeah, they have but a little again, bit of the specular highlights and stuff. Although Aqua is a great example. Think of Aqua was so internally consistent. It also, by the way, had buttons that had semicircular end caps, but it was all simulated, static, glossy. It looks like a translucent cylinder of blue, clear blue plastic or something, or clear blue glass. Nothing behind them ever showed through those buttons. They were 100% opaque. And the corners of the windows in Aqua, tack sharp, exact squares on the bottom corner radiuses, because the toolbar had corner radiuses because no content was in the title bar. The title bar had corner radiuses because no content was in the title bar. Title bars were opaque, except for when the window was in the background, in which case they showed through the desktop, not the content behind them. And the bottom corners were squares, so you could see. So the content area had sharp corners, so you could see every pixel of the content in like the preview app or whatever on macOS 10.0. But the buttons had circular end caps on them. How did they make that design work? They did that from day one, and they said, this is what it's going to look like, and our buttons are going to look like pieces of glass, and our windows are going to have pinstripes and sharp. Like, it was such a more coherent, sensible design than the hodgepodge we have now. And I think what you're noticing, Marco, is like, how do we band-aid these buttons? We still want them to look glassy, but they have to be more opaque, and people can't see the edges of them, so let's put a dark outline around them. It's almost like they're taking accessibility options and making them the default, because bordered buttons is an accessibility option, but what you get by default in Golden Gate is like slightly bordered buttons, because they were hard to see, and they can't, you know, they can't fix the design entirely, because the design of like Aqua, you know, had like the buttons stood out so much from the background. These buttons didn't, and they had to make them stand out a little bit while still being glassy. Anyway, we'll probably have more to say about this once we start loading the OS, as Marco has used it a little bit. I haven't even loaded it yet because I'm still working on a release on one of my apps, and I need to keep this machine on Tahoe, my other dev machine. But yeah, and then the final thing we'll try to do quickly, icons are off by default in menus.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible, incredible.
I'm surprised they walk that back. We've talked about it in past shows. I don't think icons and menus are actually a terrible idea, but their implementation of it was terrible. Yes. And so they've just said, never mind. It's a setting. It is off by default, which doesn't mean there's no icons in menus, but I guess the setting is, hey, if in macOS 15, if there was an icon in the menu, there will still be in this mode. When you turn them on, all the other icons appear. But I feel like this is them basically admitting defeat and saying, developers don't want to add these to the degree they existed in 26. We're going to leave it off by default, and eventually I assume that switch will go away and those icons will just be gone.
Wait, I don't actually know if that's... Is it a user setting, or is it just a developer API thing where you can say as a developer, this item needs a label?
I thought it was a user setting, but
I can't find it. But
Golden Gate,
I thought it was an API set or an API thing. Not a
it is at least
API
also
thing.
An API thing. I'll mention is sidebars now on the Mac. They got their accent color back for the
icon. I was going to bring this up too.
Which is first of all, great. You notice it immediately, and yes, it helps a lot, because as it turns out, using multiple factors to distinguish things that matter in a user interface, don't just use shapes, use colors also.
Imagine if you could have different color icons.
Right.
Imagine
the more you can communicate with people with different visual cues, the easier it is to use these things typically. But the one thing they did, so they obviously also had to solve the problem of it being difficult to determine what the current selection is. So what they've done is, because the in Alan Dye's design world, contrast is the enemy. And so what has indicated the selection so far has been in the extremely light-colored sidebar, the currently selected item has a extremely light-colored box around it. So what they've done in Golden Gate, it still is a very light-colored sidebar with a very light-colored box around the selected item, but now the font of the selected item's text is bold. Now, this, I see what they're going for. They're going for make it easier to distinguish. The problem is when text is bold, it gets wider. And so now you have the selected item changing its size as the selection changes. This is not the approach. Just have a higher contrast selection state. For God's sakes, we've solved this so many times in interfaces.
They can't solve everything. Someone's out there saying, but we could do the thing that we know it works, but let's think of something else. And they won that argument.
But here's overall, though, like with these design tweaks, what I want to see, you know, I mentioned earlier that iOS 7 changed a lot during its beta period, and Liquid Glass did not. I'm hoping this year, with this new kind of, you know, listening to feedback and fixing problems kind of approach, and with a lot less Alan Dye in the organization, I'm hoping that this will all be like a little bit tweakable during the course of this summer and fall. Hopefully, they take feedback. They see that this is a pretty good 1.1, you know, rough draft. I think it can be tweaked to be even better. I think they will hear that from a lot of people. And hopefully this is, again, a rough draft, not their new design team saying, all right, this time we got it 100% right and we're not going to change any of this stuff.
One other quick thing they did is they gave us glass effects in the icons, which is useful, I think, because, you know, that's one place you might want the cool effects. The icon composer gives you more previews of how it's going to look in 26 and 27, which is useful because they changed how it looks. And then the final thing is, I don't know what the story on this on iOS is. I haven't installed the betas, but on macOS, as far as I can tell from people screenshot and reporting on it, in Tahoe, on the phone, when you look at like your home screen in iOS 26 and you like tilt your phone around, it changes where like the light highlight, like the specular highlight around the edges of the icon is. Like it changes that as you tilt the phone to try to show it's like glinting off the icons. In macOS, I don't think even on laptops they use it, but on a desktop Mac, the desktop map is not being tilted ideally while you're using it, unless you're on a boat, I guess. And so they had to pick a light direction for the icons in Tahoe, and they picked essentially 45 degrees coming from the upper left going down to the lower right. And so the icons would have a glean on their upper left corner and a little glean on their lower right corner. In 27, they have changed it so it's from top to bottom. The light hits the top of the icon and puts a little glint on it, and then it also puts a little glint on the bottom edge, which I think it looks a little bit less awkward and a little bit nicer, but just FYI, the light has moved.
Good to know. All right, so then they talked about how they are optimizing the parts of the system that make a big difference in the performance of our products. And this includes things that they can just tweak timing on, like animations, but also they genuinely made things faster. They said 30% launch improvements on iOS and iPadOS for launching apps because they're preloading data, and they didn't say much more than that. They also talked about one of the things that drives me freaking crazy, which is when you take a picture and it doesn't get sucked into the photo library vortex for like 30 seconds, 60 seconds. So, you know, you take a picture, you immediately want to send it to, you know, say I immediately want to send it to Aaron or something like that, and I'm waiting and waiting,
mm-hmm,
and waiting for God freaking knows what, but waiting for whatever that needs to happen to happen. And they specifically called that out and said it should be 70% faster. They said a bunch of
other
things.
And yes, from the camera app, we know you can tap on it in the camera app. The reason I do that is for the reason Casey said, is if you don't tap on it when you see it in the camera app, you're going to have to go to the Photos app to find it, and that's where you're going to be waiting.
Yep. They said a whole bunch of other things were faster. We're not going to enumerate them all. They also said that network transitions are going to be better, so it's more seamless to go from cellular to Wi-Fi or vice versa. Also, another change that is so obvious once they made it, but it never occurred to me, instead of getting a like global, or maybe not global, but a conversation global indicator of sending data in an iMessage, you know, where at the top under the contact's name or whatever, you'll see the little blue bar. Now you'll get a little blue bar per message. Imagine that. My mind is blown. You're going to get one per message. I'm being snarky, but like genuinely, this will be very useful because so often I'll be in like a grocery. I feel like this only happens in grocery stores. I actually don't go into grocery stores often, but for whatever reason, on the rare occasions I do, I will try to send Aaron a picture of something and be like, hey, is this specifically what you meant? And I'm just waiting. And then I will try to describe with text what I'm looking at because the picture isn't going through. And then that's held up behind the photo. And yeah. So it seems like that is all going to get way, way, way better, which I'm super excited
for. And speaking of scheduling things, you skipped over this before, but because we don't have any deals, but they didn't mention the CPU scheduler, and they talked about what devices is going to run on. And they did not provide any information to really let you know what is different about the scheduler, but they think it's better. So stay tuned for that in future episodes.
I mean, yeah. Who had CPU scheduler on their bingo card for the keynote?
Yeah.
Like, that's, I mean, so this, you know, State so of the is, Union, maybe.
Yeah, so this is the platform improvement section. They did design, which is like, hey, look who last sucks. We're trying to fix some part of it. And then they do the part that, honestly, this should be, and this kind of is, but should really be in every single keynote, or at least every single WWDC, which is things that exist, we made them better. And most of the time in the good WWCs, they do this. But this section was just about, oh, there's stuff that exists. Could it be faster? Yeah, we think it can. We let people spend the year trying to make a bunch of stuff faster and better. The network transitions is not a speed thing, even though it was listed here. It's like, it's an aspect of your device, and it could be better. So we made it better, and we'll tell you about it. And they should do that every single year. And I think they do it every single year. Very often it doesn't make it into the keynote, but I'm glad it got its own section here. And this is they kept going. There's more of this stuff. Like, the next one was search, which is like, we know our search kind of sucks sometimes, and we know users don't understand why. And we're going to say some vague stuff that's saying, we rebuilt the foundation of search. We don't know what that means yet, but all we know is, hey, search has been kind of crappy, like when the Spotlight Index doesn't update, or when the Spotlight Indexer goes crazy and kills your Mac, or when you try to search for something on your phone and it doesn't find it, or when it gets corrupted and you have to restore your phone. We don't know the details of what the problem is, but I think everyone has experienced bad search on Apple devices. So them coming in the keynote and saying, we've rebuilt the foundation of search, and we've re-architected the search index, cautiously thumbs up, because the old one was bad, so I hope the new one is good.
I hope so. I mean, so I will, you know, so part one of this is, yes, I believe what they have said in their coded way was, we rebuilt, like, the whole, like, MDS worker stat, like, the whole, like, Spotlight database index thing, like, that has been historically pretty fragile, and you've had to do a lot of really weird things. In fact, just recently, Craig Hockenberry blogged about how if your Spotlight index gets corrupt on an iOS device, you basically can't rebuild it. You have to, like, restore the phone or something. Like, it's a terrible situation to be in, and there's, like, no recovery process.
And that's why you can easily Google for, like, how do I rebuild the Spotlight index from the command line on my Mac? That's easy to find. You know why that's easy to find? Because it's a thing that Mac users occasionally have to do and have since the advent of Spotlight, and that's not a reliable system. And that's another example of a system that's like, well, you rolled this out, and I'm sure you've changed it over the years, but, like, it's certainly not getting better, and it certainly seems like it's getting worse. Let's just hope this isn't another... was it MDNS responder or whatever? Mm-hmm. What was the thing where they rewrote a major component of macOS and then
Discovery D.
It worked so much worse than the old one, they had to roll it back. Let's hope that's not the case here. But on keynote day, where I'm willing to believe that the new one is going to be better, and I'm looking forward to it, because this is a part of all the, this is a part of all their platforms that needed to be improved. So thumbs up.
I will say, though, the other part of this, though, is so what they said was that you know, when you first run any new 27 OS, it basically will re-index everything on your computer, and that is, so far from what I can tell on my laptop, that is not only true, but also about an hour after I installed it, I ran out of disk space.
That's cool.
And so I deleted a couple of, you know, emptied the trash, deleted a couple of quick files, you know, that I had time for right before the show. And I have a Finder window open, and I have the status bar showing on the bottom.
Just watching the space
and
go down.
I'm just watching it, like, tick down, like, 10 megabytes every few seconds, or, you know, 100 megabytes every few seconds. Like, it's like 52.57 gigs. And 52.53 gigs, like, it just 52.5, like, that, it just going down as I'm talking, just watching it fill my disk again. So I don't know, I haven't had time to check, but presumably that is the re-indexing process, like, slowly building up an index somewhere on disk.
Or it could be a bug and it's just filling your disk with garbage, but the good news is the SSDs are really cheap right now, so.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. All right, so continuing
and it's
on.
It's a good thing they're all upgradable on Apple laptops, too.
Right, exactly.
Oh, good point. All right, I'm going to try to pick up the pace, and it's not going to work, but I'm going to try. This is, I think, the second feature of John's keynote. The more I think about this, actually, this really was your keynote.
See, well,
because,
I'm excited about it.
Yep. So you got your liquid glass refinements, which we all knew you would, but now you've got another new feature, full-res photos in shared albums.
A miracle. I didn't even know they could they do that? Do they have the technology to provide full resolution photos? You would think not, considering shared photo albums were just so long ago that the reduced res, like, made sense from, like, a bandwidth and like storage space perspective. That was a long time ago. Thank goodness. Full res photos, and also Windows and Android people can join in, so you can actually use shared albums to share an album without any of the caveats. The caveats used to be, well, of course, you can't see these unless you have a phone, although there was a web view, which was crappy, and those people didn't feel like they were really participating because they have to go to some crappy web page, and I don't even know if that's still supported. And the other caveat was, but of course, you can't actually share photos, because what if someone wants that photo? You're like, oh, can you give me that photo? I'll send you the full res version, because the shared album ones were reduced res. And I mean, I know most people don't care, because little, you know, kids take screenshots of photos, and that's how they share photos. And but, like, honestly, it's embarrassing. Full res photos and shared albums. Thank goodness. Happy about that.
Yep, very much so. It's just, everything's coming up Milhouse. I wanted to quickly mention that they mentioned cycle tracking now has support for perimenopause, menopause, which is good that they remember that.
Everything coming up me. I'm an old person married to another old person.
Let's see. There's custom EQ on AirPods. Something for me, actually, panoramas on Vision Pro, you can now take a source that is a panorama and it can be treated as like a spatial scene where they synthesize depth to it, which, okay, fine, whatever. But they said you can also use these spatial scenes as environments. So if you don't speak Vision Pro, if you recall, you can put yourself on like the moon, on Saturn, next to a lake. I forget where the lake is. It doesn't matter. There's several other
3D desktop wallpaper.
It's like a 3D desktop wallpaper. That's a very good summary. Thank you. Well, now you can use your own images as that 3D desktop wallpaper, which is super cool because I've seen some incredible panorama. I've taken some great panoramas. Heck, I haven't done it yet this trip, but some of my favorite panoramas are from here at Cape Charles. So, you know, I could use one of those as my background. I could transport myself back to the beach, which is super cool. I've seen some great ones of like Disney World, for example, if that's your thing, because it is for me. So I think that's really neat. John,
It's a shame though, by the way, that the spatial scenes that you're taking are not 3D in the same way as the actual environments, because the actual environments you can like, crane your head over and look on the side of a rock that you couldn't see the side of before, but that's not going to work with the photos you take. So but still, like, for the purposes of like desktop wallpaper, if you want an image that is familiar to you and not one of the ones that Apple makes or that Disney makes or one of the other companies make, it is actually a lot of work to make one of these fully 3D environment things.
Yep, super cool. And then, John, you were kind enough to pull a bunch of things from the word wall. There's a lot here. Is there anything you want to call out specifically?
Yeah, let me just go through them real quick. This is another thing that's my keynotes. I'm always looking for photos. One of my big complaints has been, you know, I spend a lot of time in photos on my Mac, and the Mac Photos app has had its feature count reduced for many years. Like, they took away a whole bunch of features when they synced it with iOS, and they just never really reconciled that.
They didn't take away
all the features, but they took away a lot of the features. And when they took them away, I'm like, okay, well, I guess the feature set that's left in Mac Photos, I guess that will be the common feature set across all of their platforms eventually. But no, they just never brought stuff from the Mac to the other platforms. And the things that I use, star ratings and keywords are two examples. Those exist, and you could do them on the Mac, kind of like they exist in like iTunes/music, but they barely are exposed in the iOS version. But anyway, keywords. I put keywords on my photos. I have been for years and years. Those keywords are nowhere to be found on the iPhone. You can't set them on the iPhone. Star rating, same thing. So they added them. This is in their word wall, so I don't know the details of this. And when I say word wall, we really mean a wall of words. This was in this section of the presentation where they're like, platform improvements. And they said, also, all this other stuff. And I screenshotted it and just copied and pasted the text, you know, with the OCR thing and preview.
Yep.
And so this is what I got from it. It says, star ratings and photos, add keywords to photos and videos, expire your shared albums, which is a useful feature because sometimes you're done with the vacation, you don't want to be up there anymore. Additional participant permissions in shared albums, which I guess you can say, you can edit photos and you can add photos or whatever. You can react with emoji in shared albums. I don't know what this one is, but I'm intrigued. Option to prioritize syncing to iCloud photos. Is that where I can say, sync this picture now? Faster to start uploading it to iCloud photos? That sounds good. FaceTime is going to have dual camera use, so you can show your face and the thing that you're looking at the same time, which will help when I'm trying to debug stuff with my parents. Notes has some new stuff. You can draw in Notes in macOS now. Imagine if you could like touch your screen and draw. Anyway.
Imagine.
Section links in Notes, copy and paste as markdown in Notes, iPadOS gets iPhone app resizing. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. Interesting. optional persistent menu bar on iPad, so you can have the menu bar show all the time. Undo and redo home screen edits in iPadOS. That's nice. I don't know if these are macOS or iPadOS, because again, it's a word wall and I can't tell, but they say more consistent window positioning persistent across external displays. Those are music to anyone's ears. I don't know what platform they're even talking about. Is it iPad? Is it Mac? But yes, remember where my windows are on my displays. More high resolution, high refresh rate display modes for external displays. Again, is that iPad or Mac? Either way, thumbs up. More distinct active windows. We've slowly rediscovering the technology of being able to tell which window is active by distinguishing it visually. We used to know how to do it, but all those people left, and now we don't know. Updated menu bar icons. What the hell does that mean?
removes them.
I think removing most of them, yeah.
We updated them by removing them.
Not in the menus. Menu bar icons. Like
look
in your menu bar right now. The sound icon and like the, you know, like that's not what they mean. Oh. Not in menus. Menu bar icons.
Well,
that's
the Siri
icon's
right? Different.
Yeah.
It's that weird half wave thing.
Yeah. Option click to secondary sort. This is just in the word wall, okay? But that's just like for people are familiar with the old set of table views. You could like click one of the headers to sort, and you could click to sort ascending and descending. But then you could option click one of the other headers to do a secondary sort. So you could sort ascending by album title, and the option click the next thing by like year or something. Anyway, I don't know what that applies to, but I'm excited by it. I don't even know what OS these are. Updated app icons. What apps? Did you change every app icon? But I'm excited by that because I didn't like a lot of the Tahoe icons. So updated app icons. Independent alarm volume. That's kind of like having independent alert volume, but it's cool to be able to control that separately. Again, what OS? I have no idea.
Oh my God, I just validated one that's on here. Smoother scrolling in calendar.
Nice.
It's true. Oh my God, it actually scrolls like a normal app now.
iPhone mirroring has app resizing, another interesting thing that we'll talk about in a little bit. DRM video support in iPhone mirroring, which is nice. The word wall is huge. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. There's even more stuff there. Those are just the ones that excited me the most.
All right, then we get to trust and safety. This is helmed by Sumbul Desai, who's VP of Health. They really hammered home a lot that safety features, whatever they're about to be, and we'll talk about it, were based on experts in research. They kept saying over and over again that this isn't, or they were hinting and saying in a roundabout way, basically, this isn't Apple just up and deciding what the best practices are for all these different things. They were going to the American Association or Society, whatever it is, for pediatrics. They were going to all these other different organizations that at least at one point were reputable, who knows now. But they talked a lot about children and devices, a lot. And they talked about how you should have a child account for any of your children that you are, you know, acting as a parent of.
Do you know what that is? Is that an existing thing? Am I just behind the times?
I think it's just an Apple ID. I think it's an Apple ID where the birth date is known and known to be that of a child. I think it's as simple as that.
Or was it a family sharing distinction? Like, is it like, because you can have a kid account in your family.
Yeah, I think it's Apple ID, but they also said you can convert existing accounts to child accounts. So that goes with what Casey was saying. It's like maybe you have an Apple ID for your kid, but it doesn't have a birth date associated with it. So you can, quote unquote, convert it to a child account by putting a truthful birth date into the Apple ID, and then it becomes a child account. Anyway, this section, trust and safety, as Casey was saying, basically is about, I'm not going to say child restrictions, but about restrictions on the usage of Apple products. What do they call this when they first sort of like started really emphasizing this?
It's like digital health or
digital well-being or something.
Yeah.
This is very similar. It does have more of a child focus, but they have essentially overhauled every one of their features that lets you limit how much you or someone else can use Apple's products, like monitoring how much they're using them, limiting how much they're using them. Again, some people use this on themselves. Parents use it on the kids. And as Casey said, they keep referencing these expert organizations, but they also emphasized, I forget the exact quote, but they were like, parents are in the best position to decide what's right for their kids. Even that seemingly, who could possibly disagree with that statement? Unfortunately, it's a complicated world, and there are, you know, kids who have parents who do not let them be who they actually are. And so giving them more electronic control over their lives is worse for those kids than when they had more like a, you know, could secretly see things on their computer that was in the room without their parents being supervising them or whatever. There is no perfect solution to this, but I think Apple has had tools, digital well-being tools and parental control tools for years, and my complaint about them has always been that they don't really work. Screen time has never worked consistently for me. It has always showed statistics that don't make any sense based on what I know to be true. It the screen time statistics would never match from device to device to the same person. So what even is the point? This device says you use this long. This device says you use that long. Like, which one is right? We have three devices and three different answers for everything. And also, the restrictions were so incredibly easy for kids to get around that it was just terrible. So this entire section of the talk is, we have overhauled everything having to do with digital well-being and parental controls, and we've added a ton of new features, and like a lot of things we've talked about in the past, I'm saying you needed to fix this. You needed to overhaul it. Fingers crossed that it actually works this time. And if it doesn't work, fingers crossed that you fix it until it does work, because they essentially left screen time to rot, and it became mostly a joke among kids. So I know there are lots of downsides to this. I know that a lot of kids don't want their parents to have even more control over their electronic lives. But on the flip side, a lot of well-meaning parents do want to have some kind of control and knowledge. They want to be able to give their kid a device at whatever age their friends get it while still having it be locked down or whatever. And the features they showed allow good, conscientious parents to better serve themselves and their kids. They also allow bad parents to be worse parents, unfortunately, and that is the double-edged sword of technology.
Yeah, I think there's also we can't forget the environment that they are doing this in right now in the world, in the political and regulatory environment. There is a huge number of age verification requirements and regulations going into effect all over the world, all over the U.S. They are well-meaning, although in many ways pretty problematic.
I was going to say they're not
well-meaning. Well, it's
almost universally not well-meaning.
I think the people who support them, who like hear about it and say that's a good idea, I think they have well-meaning behind that.
The public that supports them usually has good intentions, but the yes. people who are proposing the bills absolutely do not. And the reason they're getting voted for is because it's the surveillance state. That's what people want. So the people who propose these bills and the politicians who support them have terrible motivations. The citizens who hear about it and say that sounds like a good idea, they're well-meaning.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Because, like, you know, when you hear something like we need to protect children from inappropriate material, it's like, okay, that seems fine. But then once you get into how and what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. By gathering information about every human on the planet. Does that sound good?
Yeah, it's like, oh, what if we take a picture of every kid's face and store it in a database?
We want to know who you are and how old you are and your social security number. We're going to store that somewhere and it will never be hacked. Don't worry.
Mm-hmm. We're going to store it. We're going to have, maybe that's a global identification system. just for verification. Yeah, don't worry. It won't be in an S3
bucket. We know everything about you, and these private companies are going to store it, and don't worry, they'll take care of that data. No problem. They won't sell it to anybody. It will never get hacked. You'll never lose it. It's just a terrible idea.
And what private companies, and what are they getting out of it? And yeah. It's just, I mean, the whole thing is such a mess. And then of course you go into like, okay, well, in many places, you know, content is considered dangerous or illegal that I think maybe you and I might not think is dangerous or illegal. Think about places where certain sexualities or gender identities are considered illegal still. That's a very big thing still in the world. It's a huge battleground in so many places.
Or even just in our country where some yes. gay kid's going to want to learn about themselves so they can't go to any of those pages because anything having to do with anything that's not heterosexuality is deemed equivalent to porn.
Right.
Which is ridiculous.
Or gender-affirming care.
That's how, like, these laws are structured.
Yeah, like, you know, if you think you're trans and you want to, like, maybe read a little bit more about that or, you know, consider some of those ideas. Like,
you're too young to know about that even though you're
right.
living it.
Yeah, it's like we've had throughout our history a lot of, like, you know, banned content in various ways, banned books, you know, banned political ideas and banned ideologies and concepts. And, you know, we as a society are not good at making good decisions around that and controlling that, you know, uniformly. And so in the political environment that we're operating in, getting back to the topic, Apple has a target on its back, because so does every other major tech gateway company, that all of these regulators and legislators around the world keep saying, well, you created this entire controlled walled garden, so that means when we want to dictate what people can do, we just have to go to you. It isn't like, you know, if you're trying to, like, block something on the open web, it's much harder. There's a lot more parties involved. You have to, it's kind of a game of whack-a-mole. You can't really ever fully get everything. But if you're a tech gatekeeper on a lockdown platform, you can do whatever the government forces you to do. So Apple has created this problem and put themselves in this position, but they also recognize they are in this position. And so now, as all of these laws are either threatened to be put in place or actually are enacted around the world, Apple, I think, recognized we need to get ahead of this. And because you see what happens if Apple, in their gatekeeper position, if there's a regulatory upswell of some feelings around the world and Apple doesn't get ahead of it, you end up with something like the DMA in the European Union, where it's like, okay, well, the regulators have decided that your version of lockdown and app store control and fees and everything is anti-competitive. Apple has decided not to even do anything at all about that whatsoever, unless they are absolutely forced to. And so what happens? Governments regulate them, and sometimes they go pretty far in that regulation in ways that might be either impractical, certainly undesirable for Apple for other reasons other than financial reasons, could hurt the product in various ways. Well, that same thing could happen with all these age requirement laws everywhere and you know, verification and everything. So in this case, this is Apple, I think, trying to get ahead of that instead of what they did with the App Store rules, which was nothing. Now they're trying to get ahead of it a little bit so that way they can go talk to the you know the different politicians and legislators that are trying to enforce probably more draconian, more ridiculous measures and say, look, we have done all the research. We've worked with these different groups and the American Association of Pediatrics and all these different – we've worked with all these people and created this fully you know safe, proven system that addresses these needs, and therefore you don't have to regulate us any further. Like that's kind of the move here. So I think that that's why we're seeing this now. Now, as a parent who uses screen time – for my kid, all of these improvements to screen time are certainly welcome because it is a really simplistic and limited system, and it's
and easy to get around.
Yeah, screen time. It's been one of those Apple features, like I was talking about last week, where they kind of like did like an 80% job and then just never touched it again, for years and years and years. So this is nice to see. I see why they're doing it now. I think it's a good idea to do it now. And I trust Apple to do this kind of thing well if it has to be done at all. Now, as John was saying a few minutes ago, there is the question of like, well, are there any downsides to this being done at all? But the world is deciding on its own that they're going to force these kind of restrictions on tech platforms. They're going to force this no matter what. So in that context, I trust Apple to do it better than anyone else and in a way that considers, you know, things that don't follow the simplistic storyline better than anybody else, including things like what if the parents, you know, what if parents are trying to keep down their gay kid? Like that's like there's all those or, you know, what about like domestic abuse situations? Like there's all sorts of situations that like when platforms talk about or develop or think about, you know, permissions based systems like this or access control systems, there's a lot of those kind of, you know, messy realities that they don't consider. And then that becomes a bad scene for a lot of people. Apple historically has been much better than everyone else at handling that kind of, you know, breadth of concepts, considering all of these different cases and doing the best they can with them.
Yeah, assuming it works. Again, that's always the caveat. Although I will say, I don't think in this case this is going to save Apple. Like, unlike the DMA stuff, the DMA is trying to make them do a thing that would be beneficial to everybody. Now the laws are trying to make Apple do a thing that is not beneficial to anybody except for, again, the surveillance state and people who want to own this data. And to give an example of that, and all these laws that are being passed that Apple doesn't like, they're going to say, well, it's well and good that you did all that, Apple, but you know, you just ask people to enter their ages. Like you ask parents to enter their kids' ages. You ask people to voluntarily enter their ages. What's stopping them from just lying about their age? Because that's whenever you hear age verification stuff, well, shouldn't we, you know, like kids shouldn't be able to see things they shouldn't see. So, if you know, but like, well, what if they lie about their age? That's where we get into the whole gathering your identity, because they can't just say, hey, please enter your age here. Like, no, no, no. You have to prove that you're 18 years old or 19 years old or 20 years old. You can't just say it, because what's the point in adding a dialog box that says type your age here? Okay, 57, boom. And like anybody can type a number. They need to get your identity. They need to know who you are. You need to prove who you are. So what do we gather for that? A government ID, a picture of you, your birth certificate, your social security number, you know, like go through a verification agency that will gather all your biometric data and vouch for you. That like, that's where this becomes a problem. Apple is doing none of that. When you create a child account, an adult just enters. I have a kid. This is their birthday. That's them. You can type anything you want there. I have fake children Apple IDs right now. For kids that don't exist for the purposes of testing. Yeah. Nothing is like, that was Apple's whole big point here. We consulted with experts and we're putting it in the hands of the parents. And the government's saying, no, 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 the laws we want to pass say you can't do any of that because then anyone can enter anything they want. And Apple's like, we trust parents, we trust our users. That's the way we want to do it. And these laws are like, you can't trust parents, you can't trust users, you certainly can't trust kids. You know, you can trust this giant corporation that's going to leak all your data. Right, exactly. That's the bind we're in. So I feel for Apple here. I agree that they're trying to do what they're trying to do is in general a good idea. It does have some scary downsides, but the much scarier thing are the laws that are being, and I'm just talking about U.S. laws. The laws in other countries where people can be executed for being gay is like, that's a whole other ball of wax. Even just in the U.S., depending on what state you're in, things are already pretty grim. So I think it is interesting that fully one-third topic-wise of the keynote was on the topic of trust and safety, and it was essentially all about digital well-being and parental controls. And again, it all looks good, and it's a vast improvement of what came before. I hope they did a good job implementing it, but I fear that it's not going to be enough.
Yeah, I mean, everything you guys said is exactly right. It was interesting watching this for me, because as Declan's fifth grade graduation kind of present, and in many ways, it's a self-serving thing. We got him an Apple Watch SE. This is his first like real honest to goodness device.
Is it an SE3?
Yes, and I know that's
then run the new watchOS.
Yeah, exactly. he was using a iPhone that does not have service. You know, it's effectively an iPod Touch at this point, as a noisemaker in his room, like to do white noise in the background while he sleeps. And so we had done a little bit of screen time on that, like screen time related settings on that to make sure he's not, you know, futzing with that during times he shouldn't be. But now he has a device that, you know, is places other than his bedroom. And so we had to take a much closer look at screen time. And I can tell you, it's not very clear or easy to set up. It's unclear how they really expect things to happen. Like, none of it is very well done. And they went through in the keynote, you know, what, who, when, and how with regard to kid related things. So what content can kids see? One of the big things they announced is ask to browse for websites. So in the same way that you have, you know, may I download this app, please, you can have, may I go to this website? And apparently this is turned on by default for kids under 13 years old. They have who you can talk to. And this is something that we were running into with Declan, because we don't personally, for us, we don't currently want him to have unfettered access to any contact, you know, under the sun. We would like to be able to vet the people that he's putting in his watch to send text messages with. And as he gets older, we'll probably stop doing that. But for today, we would like that. And so that's kind of very kludgy in screen time settings right now. And now there's also a ask for permission to connect, which is really great, because that'll make those sorts of things much, much easier. They also kind of flipped on its head, or maybe not flipped on its head, but took a different approach to screen time scheduling. So, you know, we could say you can't use your device after, you know, 7 or 7:30 at night or what have you. Well, now, that is still true, but now you can also say, well, you know, any app in the realm of games, you can have 30 minutes a day, an hour a day, 2 hours a day, etc. So they're doing time allowances. This is when kids can have access. They do time allowances rather than a specific schedule. And I think some of this was already available, but it was an app by app basis. And now you can do it in like a group basis. And I think that that's very clever as well. And then how parents can guide kids. They said the words, we've completely redesigned screen time. You can pause device use entirely. You can also allow unlimited use. So there's a very easy button right at the top, or a trio of buttons: pause, allow unlimited, and change schedule. Because another thing you can do is get more robust scheduling. So school days are these rules, weekends are these rules. They also talked about how there's a bunch of APIs available for developers as well to leverage with this. They did also mention that there's a setup assistant, which is basically a Windows wizard, which I, you know, chortled about because it's very clunky, but also the way you set it up right now is even clunkier. So I'm actually kind of excited about that. And there's also going to be a new child safety website, which they mentioned as well. So that's pretty cool. All right. And then we get to, I think, the final of the triumvirate, if I'm not mistaken, which is Apple Intelligence and Siri. And one of the things that was said verbatim, I believe, is some seem to be pursuing AI for the sake of AI. And I think that is extremely well said. As I said, I believe in the top of the show, I am very enthusiastic at this point, before we get to the State of the Union, where Apple seems to be taking what I consider to be a much more Apple-y and much more effective approach to AI, which is, what are the ends we're trying to do? And are those ends able to be met by some of these new technologies? So they have a bold new architecture for Apple Intelligence and Siri centered around you and the Apple products you use every day. Again, so far so good. Then they started talking about Apple Foundation models. Craig said, again, either verbatim or close to, This year, we embarked on a deep collaboration with Google, leveraging the technologies behind their Gemini family of models. Together, we created the next generation of Apple Foundation models for our integrated Apple Intelligence experiences and adapted these new models to run on-device and on servers using private cloud compute.
So if you're wondering if Google was going to get a mention of Gemini, not only did they get a mention, they got a very generous, for on the Apple scale things mentioned. Together we created. It's a collaboration between Apple and Google. They named Google. They named Gemini. They attributed this product to a collaboration, a deep collaboration with Google. I don't think that was contractually obligated. It sounded like they wanted to say this. Some people were cynically saying, well, now when it goes wrong, they can just blame Google for when Siri tells you to put glue on pizza or whatever. But, I could have gone either way on this. A lot of thought went before this keynote. It was like, will they even mention Google at all? Or will they just say it's Apple Intelligence? Again, there was that quote-unquote joint press release many months ago that was only released by Google. I mean, obviously, it had Apple's blessing because it talked about Apple in it, but that made me think, like, oh, they're not going to mention Google at all, but, like, how could they avoid it? And they didn't. It is a deep collaboration with Google. We'll see how long this deep collaboration lasts. Again, they previously had a pretty deep collaboration in 2024 with OpenAI, and that one doesn't seem to be going as well. So, but anyway, for now, Google helped us fix our crap. Yep. Good. Hope. We hope. Good. We hope.
Yep. So there's going to be new, more powerful on-device model or models, higher accuracy dictation, heck yes, mm-hmm. better natural language understanding, heck yes, a new system orchestrator, personal context understanding. They said that behind the scenes, Apple Intelligence uses Spotlight, and all of us went, ugh.
But the good one, the new one, not the old one.
Right, right.
Yeah. This time it works, we swear.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, we shall see about this. There. Speaking of the new Siri, by the way, there is a waiting list in the beta. So if you install the beta, it says, oh, you want to use the new Siri? Join the waiting list. So, I mean, obviously, it's the first beta, and they're still rolling things out. But just FYI, if you're rushing to install the beta so you can try the new Siri, you're going to be on the waiting list, probably.
But at least you'll be close to the top, I guess. Oh, and actually, can we pause right now? We do this every year. I'm going to do it again. I should have done this at the top of the show, but I'm going to do it now.
Pull over, order your t-shirts.
Pull over, atp.fm/store.
No, don't buy those. There aren't the good ones.
No, I'm kidding. For the love of God, do not put betas on any device you care about. Marco, I believe you said you were doing it on an alternate device, if I'm not mistaken.
I have it on my laptop, and I actually just ordered a refurbished iPhone Air because I want to run the new models. Like the high-end models, I want to test my all my transcription stuff with them. And the only iPhone that I own that can run the big new models is my personal iPhone 17 Pro, and because it can only run on the 17 Pro and the Air. So
just list the other devices while we're talking about this. The new, more powerful on-device models runs on iPhone Air, so iPhone 17 Pro, iPad with M4 and later. So that's not a lot of iPads.
Just the latest Air and the Pro, right?
Yeah. And a Mac with M3 and later, and you need at least 12 gigs of RAM.
Oof, so, I barely made it in on my M3
Max. So if you have an
Max.
8-gig Mac, that's not going to save you. M3 and later, yeah. So
yeah.
I'm assuming if you have a machine that is older than that, you'll just get the older existing on-device models.
Well, it's based on what they were saying, it sounds like there's actually two new model classes. It sounds like they made the foundation models better for all devices that could run them before, which, iPhone 15 Pro and, so it's all devices that can run Apple Intelligence models locally before. I think those are getting new models. But then also there's an even larger, more sophisticated set of local models that these higher end or newer devices are getting. And in the iPhone family, it's only the Air.
You can probably guess which Gemini models are like replaced Apple's old foundation models and which Gemini models are their new, more powerful ones. I'm sure Apple has tweaked them in whatever ways they want.
Yeah.
Regardless, they also said that there is going to be broad world knowledge, including going to the web. You can do app actions, which I don't remember them ever having referred to it that way before, but maybe I'm wrong. Also, on-screen awareness. And at this point, they trot out Mike Rockwell, the fixer who is allegedly going to fix new Siri, And let me tell you, if you are to believe the keynote, and we are recording this hours after the keynote, we're recording it on Keynote Monday, we've barely had time to do, well, John and I haven't had time to put any betas anywhere. Marco has barely had any time to put betas anywhere. I don't think I ever closed the loop on that. Don't put the beta on any device. I think I briefly said that, but don't do it.
Not the first beta anyway.
Yeah, definitely not the first beta.
Maybe wait for the public beta.
Exactly right. But anyway, we at this point, we are in full, it's all going to be great, man. That's where we are right now. So let's take this all with, you know, copious amounts of salt. But
yeah. And so this thing they had here was, as Marco said, it's a dual shot. It's split screen. On the left is Mike Rockwell holding his phone, and you can see him from the waist up. And on the right is a hand holding an iPhone. And it's very clear from the second they start doing this demo, that's his hand. What you see on the left, the shot on the right is a close-up of the hand that you see on the left. You know that because when his finger twitches on the left, the finger twitches on the right. Like, these are live, synced in time, real-time shots. Now, first of all, setting aside what we're going to talk about in a second, which is the convincing everybody this is not fake, look at the angle he's... I should put a freeze frame of this, but if not, go to the thing. Look at the angle he's holding his phone. He's looking at his phone screen. He's holding it so that it is facing him. And I'm like, where is the camera that is shooting?
Yeah.
Like, you can see just out of frame, I'm sure maybe they CG'd part of it out, but just out of frame, there is a huge camera and lighting rig pointed over his shoulder at the phone to get what I think is an amazing shot of a real iPhone where you can read the screen where it doesn't look like the phone is not pointed at the camera. I just, the staging of this, and they probably had him practice, hold your hand exactly here at exactly, but it doesn't, you could have him hold it like, oh, he's clearly holding his phone so it's pointing towards the camera. He doesn't even look like he's using it. No, he looks like he's using his phone, and yet they're still managing to get a shot. So A+ for whoever set up this shot, just on the, like, the logistics and the quality of the appearance. Now, Mike Rockwell is a human being, and I guess they didn't want to do too many takes of this, and he speaks with his hands. So occasionally you'll see his other hand fly up into the frame on the right side, which is another really human moment of just like, they probably told him not to do that, but he gets excited and his hand moves and it appears in a frame. It is very human and very straightforward. Again, kind of like when Steve Jobs would have like the overhead projector camera pointing down at his phone that would be attached with a tether so it could show on the big screen. And he'd, you know, it kind of reminds me of that. But kudos for him doing that. And then finally, as we discussed at length already, they needed to do this to show you this is not fake. This is a real phone. We never cut away. It's a one-er. It's a, you know, I mean, they do have cuts, but like, when he's interacting with the phone, this is it. This is software. It is running on a phone. He's talking to it. We are all to assume that this is not like a canned demo where it's just like a movie playing and he's pretending he's using it. And we are convinced of that by the fact that sometimes you have to wait an uncomfortable period of time for the new Siri to do anything. And we just see the little spinner and we go, I guess is it going to do something? And he just stands there. And again, this is a two-shot that never cut away. He's there. And he just has to sit there silently waiting for the phone to do, and then the screen comes up, and then he says his prepared statement. Oh, now it has told me blah, 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 blah. So this was simultaneously both the most uncomfortable section of the keynote, and also, I feel like, potentially the most triumphant. I think I posted on Mastodon that this is Mike Rockwell either taking his victory lap, you brought me in to fix Siri, I done fixed it. Or it's him going out there and saying, now it's my neck on the line. If this crap doesn't work, you're going to blame me because I'm, you know, this like, if you're going to fix Siri, you got to go out there and show it working. And you know how you have to show it working? A continuous shot of the phone in your hand and you use it. And that's the only convincer. It's like, we can't ship this unless this works. And it shouldn't be such a high bar because it's like, well, of course you can't ship something unless it works. Right. But in this post WWDC 2024 world, there's such skepticism about Apple ever getting this to work. They need to do everything they possibly can to say, We swear it will work this time. And I'm actually still not convinced because I haven't used it myself. But they did everything they could. So kudos to Mike Rockwell. Extra kudos to the people who set up the shot.
Yeah, and actually, a friend of mine, Rob Ryan, tweeted at Craig Hockenberry, another friend of ours, that, and this is with regard to later in the keynote, but I presume it's applicable here too. Rob said, Justin's demos were all one large take. Imagine how many times he flubbed and had to reshoot the demo. So I would assume that's true as well for Rockwell. Again, I don't know this, but that is intense, and I am impressed. And like all three of us at some point during this episode have said, I think this is exactly what they needed to do to instill some amount of confidence that this is not vaporware.
Yeah, and they show the new look of Siri, which Gurman's like mock-ups, artist mock-ups, were actually pretty accurate. One of the things I noted every time they showed the thing, especially on Mike Rockwell's particular phone that he's demoing on, when the big, like, dynamic island expands into this large liquid glassy blob where Siri does stuff with, like, an animation, and it's very clear. Like, I don't think the slider affects that. Like, it's very translucent, it's very transparent, it looks glassy, and it refracts what's behind it. And what's usually behind it are the top corners of some icons on the home screen. If you're doing it on the home screen, he's got widgets. He's got like the weather widget and the calendar at the top of the screen. And if you can look at the screenshot in my in the show notes here, I don't have the image of this for us to put in the document, but if you just watch the video, you can see it. Do you see the two little holes, the little mm-hmm. refracty mm-hmm. holes that it's making in the bottom of the lozenge? Do you see them in the notes?
Yep.
It kind of, what is that thing that we knew the name of when the 2019 Mac Pro came out? The thing that makes people people feel queasy when they see things with lots of holes in it?
Oh, yeah.
I know what you're thinking of. I can't remember what it is.
It's giving me that, and it's not just this. There was a couple other screenshots that did the same thing. Because it is so refracty and clear, it adds these artifacts that look like it has these weird sort of rotted holes in it, or it looks like an alien head or whatever. Yet another place where the idea that interface elements should be glassy and refract the things behind them is not a great idea. Even when an interface element, the whole point of it is just to be the spinny, ethereal, rainbow-colored blob, I think that's ugly, and I hope they fix that.
You know what it gives to me is Flight of the Navigator. I don't know why, but it's reminding me of the spaceship from Flight of the Navigator for whatever reason. Anyways, so Mike Rockwell is doing his victory lap. They're now calling it Siri AI, which is Siri plus Apple Intelligence. Mike said specifically, "We know there are times you expect more from Siri." Well, no shit, Sherlock.
Understatement of the century.
Right. In any case, they talk about a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to try to blast through this real fast. But they said it's a more capable assistant, and they go through an exchange where, where's Jeff's new place? Show me photos from near there. That's not exactly right, but you get the idea. They also talked about how the voice is much better and more expressive. Additionally, there's sliders like Carrot Weather style, where you can change not only the pace of the voice, so you can crank it super fast if you're a sicko like me and listen to podcasts at nearly 2x, or you can slow it way down. You can also crank up or down the expressivity.
I so wanted to turn the expressibility to max, because I want to say, how far does that go? Because it sounded pretty expressive, the one where it's like, I'm so excited to read this sentence because I think it should be read and excited, but they never moved the expressibility. They just changed the speed slider. I'm like, put that expressivity to the max. I want to hear it. So,
this
yeah,
is like
cool.
Like new ways to prank your friends. Like, go change that setting on their phone.
Yeah, exactly. Put it on slowest speed, highest expressivity.
But then they said it's more conversational, and they talked here about how you can swipe down from the dynamic island to search on iOS, and search and Siri, Spotlight and Siri are all kind of one conflated thing now. They use the example, which is really bold. They use the example of what's the schedule for the upcoming weekend of the World Cup, which is the sort of thing that Siri of yore would absolutely just crap the bed on. Anything sports related, it's always wrong. It's showing you Super Bowl results from 30 years ago, whatever the case may be. Things that seem so eminently obvious, when is the football game today, asks an American, and Siri's like, some British team is playing some other British team in 3 days or whatever. It's just preposterous. And then they have a whole conversation about how I want to plan a watch party for Brazil Morocco, and they go back and forth, and this looks pretty good. Like, if we're to take on at face value that this is how this works, I'm not sure I would use Siri to help me plan a party, but the fact that it is capable of doing that, here is, I guess, actually to argue with myself, this is one of those occasions where it's like, we don't really need AI for this. Like, I'm not looking to plan a party with AI, but I am happy to know that it's
possible.
Setting
aside whether you want to do it or not, these demos are just demonstrating, look, it doesn't suck so bad anymore. I can understand what we're saying. But they always ended at least one step short of something that I think humans would actually want to do. Is they would be like, find the photos from last weekend, send only the photos with these people in them to this group chat, and blah, blah, blah. And that's just essentially demonstrating serious LLM power now. It understands what I'm saying. It no longer embarrassingly gets wrong everything about what I'm trying to say. It demonstrates. Right. The demo shows it understands me. It knows what I'm asking. And then it tries to do it. But the place where it falls down, and the reason, to your point, Casey, why people probably won't use Siri to do these types of things, setting aside that they don't trust it because they think it sucks, is that they get to the point where it's like, okay, show me the photos from this weekend, send the ones of my kids. Everyone wants to pick the specific photos. They're not going to say, but they show two photos in the thumbnails, and they're like, I think it said 37 photos, and it's like, great, send. No, you're going to want to see, maybe you don't want to send 30, you're going to want to pick the five that you want. Like, human interaction has to happen, or the thing of I'm putting together this plan, does this look okay? And you're like, show me the part where you say, actually, I want to edit that. Launch me into a text editor with this thing. Show me this as a file. Like, the final mile, the last mile of human interaction is either required or desired in many steps in this process. If you're just talking it back and forth with the agent and you're like, I'm fine with whatever you do, then your friends are going to complain, stop using that stupid AI thing to put stuff into our chat because it's just a bunch of slop, right? Say what you have to say or show us the pictures you think are good. And I get, like I said on a past thing, of like somebody who doesn't know how to use a phone saying, oh, I just started typing to my friend about a trip to Japan and it prompted me to send the photos. Like, that person does need that kind of help. But as a demo, as a general purpose thing, you need to be able to drill down. I know this is a version 1.0. We're just glad if it works at all, right? But every one of these demos, I saw the part where it's like, well, now is the part where the human's going to want to make a decision. It's like saying, book me a vacation. Like, nobody wants to do that as a real thing. You do it as a demo to show how cool your thing is, but no one wants to do that because you're like, I want to pick my flight times. I want to pick my airline. I want to pick my seats. I want to pick my hotel. You want to have input because it's your life. You know, and the difference between this and like a human assistant is, presumably, if you have a human assistant who is this skilled, you're fabulously wealthy and that you pay them a lot of money to know your actual tastes, and probably you still have complaints about it. But yeah, so these demos, as a demonstration that Siri no longer sucks, were convincing, but they were not convincing to me as a demonstration of the thing that humans are going to do with their phone.
Yeah, I mean, this is true of like almost every modern AI demo. Like, with every new AI model that comes out, every AI-based product, you know, every company that integrates AI into their stuff, they always come up with these, like, you know, kind of contrived, weird demos that no one really does or would do in that way. But also,
or if they did, their friends would yell at them about it.
Right. But also, Apple's own keynotes have always been filled with these kinds of demos. It's been less sophisticated, but they've always included some contrived situation, often being performed by Craig Federighi, that nobody would ever actually do. And also, if you tried to do it, it wouldn't work as well. Like, and this is the thing, like, you know, when I'm saying like Apple has a credibility problem with a lot of these areas, this goes back in lots of ways. Like, even before, you know, AI, and, you know, Siri has always been a big one. But even just stuff like, you know, the stuff they demo at WWDC oftentimes does not pan out the way that they seem to hope or think it will. Things like iWork documents being collaboratively edited, you know, where it's like, well, no one actually ever does that because it sucks and everyone just uses Google Docs. A lot of this new AI stuff is like, okay, well, will people actually do this with Apple's intelligence or Siri, you know, whatever version of that we're talking about? Or will they just bounce out to ChatGPT or Claude or something else and do it there because they're better? You know, like, this is two different questions. Like, number one, will Apple's version of this thing work and work reliably? And then number two, will it be competitive? And then will it stay competitive over the course of the following year if they just kind of half-assedly update it along the way? Or don't update it at all along the way, which often is the case with Apple's features. So this is a great set of promises. The demos didn't really tell us what we really want to know, which is, does it work and how well does it work? And that's the kind of thing we will only find out with time. Everybody who's ever used an Apple platform or been near a HomePod knows, like, Siri over-responds and under-delivers. We have all had pathetic Siri failures. Will this finally fix it? I mean, I like to think maybe, but I almost feel like, am I being naive for even believing that it's possible for Apple to fix it? Like, we've been burned so many times. So they need to earn our trust. That's going to take time. They might be on the path to do that with this new version of all this stuff. I hope they are, because it might not seem this way all the time, but I'm rooting for them. You know, I want them to succeed because I like and use their products. But we've just been burned so many times in these areas. What they have shown today is an interesting concept. Will it deliver? Will it be reliable? Will we actually be using all of these features a year from now? Or will we be saying at next WWDC, oh yeah, that thing they showed up, that never happened. Or, yeah, I used that once and then never again because it sucked. Or, oh, yeah, that started out pretty unreliable and now it's kind of okay. Like, or are we going to actually be integrating this stuff into our daily lives? Are we actually going to be using it so much that we don't even think about how unreliable or crappy it used to be? We don't know yet. We have to see what happens. Does this actually ship? How does it ship? Is it good? And that's, I feel like, what people are feeling with this keynote. The reason why it's kind of gotten a mixed reaction from a lot of the people I've seen is that we can't know that yet. All we have right now is more promises. Let's hope that they pan out.
Yeah, I do think the last mile problem is maybe a thing for next year's WWDC. Is like, even on the simple stuff of you're not doing an interactive, you're not planning a whole vacation, you're not planning a party or any of these silly contrived things. Although I will say, for the past contrived things, the only thing that was contrived about it was that all the person's friends were fashion models and all the pictures were amazingly taken and everything. But anyway, this one is the contrived thing of like, no one ever wants an agent to do all this stuff for them. But even for the simple stuff that you might imagine yourself doing, which is, tell me when Mom's slide is arriving, which they did not do this time. But that's just an informational thing. Even on that demo, my question would be, say they did that demo and it said, look, it works, and it told me when Mom's slide is arriving. Can I copy and paste from that window? Can I, where is the last mile? Like, oh, I want that information. And don't say, just send it in a message to blah, blah, blah. Like, at a certain point, you as the user need to jump in and say, let me do my user things. Like, that's the thing about the other ones where they're like, oh, I'm making a party invitation. Some human doing the demo would drag in the three prepared pictures of models for the thing, but they would pick them. They would pick them. They would decide where they go. The human has to have some role here other than a, offhand comment yelling to your personal assistant in the next room to do a thing. It's like, do I not have a role in my life? Like, I need to be able to jump in at any point. And these black bubbles, these Siri conversations, you can go to this app and you can see your past conversations. Okay, that's a start. But, part of, I think, the utility people get out of, the ChatGPT web interface or whatever is, it's just, you can copy and paste out of that window. There's little copy buttons next to things. You can jump to another window and do another thing. Like, the user is involved. And all these demos were like, your involvement is just giving vague directions and approving the things that I present you. And it's like, no, I need to be more involved in that. I don't need to do it all. Like, I need the assistant to assist me. But even, again, something as simple as some information, and it gives me the information. Am I just going to look at that? I probably wanted that for something. So at the very least, I need to be able to copy and paste out of the window. Now, maybe you can. Maybe you can copy and paste out of the window. But none of the demos showed anything other than I talk and bubbles appear, and maybe I press a yes or no button. And that, I think, is a non-starter. That's the reason I think people like the ChatGPT web interface, is because it's more than that, that you do participate in it. So I don't want to sound like I'm down on this, because I'm with you, Marco. Like, I want this to work, and I think it can work, and it's going to be way better than it was before, I think. But the whole industry has a ways to go on the dream of, like, it's like a smart personal assistant that knows all your tastes and can do everything for you. That doesn't exist. This demo doesn't show it. Nobody has it. It does not exist. Even finding a human assistant to do that is really difficult. And people like to think it does exist, and they like to do demos pretending it exists, but it absolutely doesn't. And instead, what people should be doing demos of is, we know the limitations of this technology. Here are all the places you can intervene to still have a successful endpoint, to still have the successful party, to still send the five pictures that you wanted to send with the help of the AI narrowing it down for you and giving you the final choice in an interface that is not a tiny black bubble floating over the whole rest of your phone screen.
Well, and what's funny is when they talked about Siri on macOS, they said it's integrated into Spotlight, blah, blah, blah. And they literally said, of course, this is a Mac, so I can drag this window anywhere and resize it to see more. I mean, we'll see what happens. I'm trying to page through our show notes.
Before we move on from that, there was one demo where, speaking of demos that they might have to do multiple times, it was their single take demos and stuff. The demo where they were doing, I forget what they were doing. They were doing some kind of Siri thing on the Mac. It was showing cool stuff, like you could multi-select files in the Finder and then say, I want to ask a Siri question about this, and basically compare these, and it makes a little table. Like, that's super useful. Again, the less limited Apple's platforms are, the more I feel like the integration of Siri can be useful, because you can multi-select a bunch of files and right-click them and say, ask Siri about them. Try doing that in the Files app on your phone with your finger. Good luck, if they even allow you. But one of the demos was like, and see, it even understands my typos, which, if anyone who has ever used LLM-based chatbots and stuff knows, you can put typos in there. You can misspell words. You can fat finger things. It deals with it just fine, because its training data is filled with typos. And so it's fine about that. It's not like it has to spell correct or something. It doesn't matter. Did that person intentionally make that typo? I think they put electrical, but they put an X because the X is near the C key on the keyboard or whatever. Did they have to practice mistyping a word in that exact way? Let's do another take. You typed it correct. Are they a touch typist? And it's hard for me to intentionally make a mistake on that specific word in this specific way. But it reminded me of the Utah road trip, where the guy was doing a Utah road trip demo of some thing that was making a slideshow or something in an old Mac keynote. and the autocorrect got him. Like, they had just added autocorrect or whatever else was in. And it autocorrected. He typoed Utah. It's supposed to be Utah Road Trip was the typo. And he the system autocorrected Utah, the misspelled Utah, to its, IT apostrophe S. So instead of Utah Road Trip, it said its Road Trip. And the guy had such a smack on forehead expression and like an upset face. And on the screen, it says its Road Trip. That was a meme for a long time. And then what Apple did was history eraser buttoned that. When they put out that video, they replaced it with another take where he successfully types Utah Road Trip, and you don't get to see the guy go, I hope someone still has that original. I think it's probably on YouTube, the original It's Road Trip thing. So this reminded me of that. It was a vague callback to It's Road Trip. It's like, see, I can do typos, and it still understands me.
It's incredible. There's a new dedicated Siri app, which we all expected. They talked about visual intelligence for a while, which mostly I didn't think was that interesting personally. But one thing that I thought was very cool was they said, and this went by super fast, so I might get the details wrong, but that you can split a bill by shooting an image of like the tab, the check or what have you. And then I'm not clear exactly how. I think Siri parses it. And then you basically somehow tell it, okay, well, Marco had this, John had that, I had this. And then it'll figure out what the total should be and split it amongst all the people, which is very cool if it actually works.
It's going to be real embarrassing when you do that and the total doesn't come out to the total of the bill.
Right, exactly.
Because, LLMs are notoriously bad at doing math unless they have specific tool use, which hopefully this does. I do wonder, like, if it would correctly split the bill, and then you say, oh, actually, make Jim pay $2 more, and then it starts. When you start doing deltas, and then at the very end, you take those numbers into a calculator and add them up, just check maybe that they equal the totals, otherwise, you know, it's stiffing people. But, yeah, it'll be cool if it works.
Yep. You can write and edit with Siri, which, I mean, whatever. I did think it was interesting, though, that when they were talking about making a document, they said you could describe a document in natural language, and they said Siri can generate a draft to get the ball rolling. I thought it was interesting that they were making it clear that the implication was we are not advocating necessarily having Siri write an entire document for you, but you can get the, you know, bones of it and then fill in what you want afterwards, which I thought was reasonable.
I saw a lot of people online complaining about this because they're like, who would ever ask an LLM to write a thing for them? And, you know, as I've said in past episodes, I encourage people to write things themselves, but I totally understand the situations, the context in which people desire something like this, which is a context in which they don't feel like they're expressing themselves anyway. This is not a place for me to express any of my knowledge or opinion about anything. In fact, this is a place where I have to perform a certain role in a way that is satisfying to others that does not require any input from me. And in that scenario, there is only downside for me trying to write this myself, because what if I failed the performance in some way? So instead, I will have a machine write this for me, because honestly, it is not an expression of myself in any way. I know this sounds terribly dehumanizing, but what I'm essentially describing is large parts of several real jobs where you have to do this. And that's where I think these tools, where the people who see this and say, yes, I would like to do that, that's where the appeal lies. Now, I still think in those scenarios, these tools are still bad, because the pros that they create is fairly easily detectable by people who are exposed to a lot of it as not being from a human. And it also encourages people not to proofread, and it allows them to just say, oh, I'll just send it. Someone else wrote it for me. I'm sure it's fine. There are very few scenarios where none of your participation is required. For example, you don't want to have the chatbot write a thing for you, and then you never read what it wrote, and then you just hit send. That's going to end badly for everybody involved. But and to be clear, I don't endorse these features, but I understand why some people see them and desire them. And I could say, oh, you shouldn't desire them because it's bad, but I understand why they desire them. Because lots of scenarios, again, people have to accomplish something that is not expressing themselves or their ideas or anything that they know, which is sad but true. And so I mean, the real solution is don't put people in those scenarios and don't require them to do that. But I mean, this was one of the sadder parts of the keynote for me, because I'm like, you can right click a document and it will write some crap for you, and it's just like every bone in my body says don't do that, but then I understand why that feature exists. So it's grim.
Yep. They talked about apps, and basically this is kind of like the grab bag section. Safari Apparently, they've been looking at your Safari windows, John. Again, everything's coming out Millhouse. You can organize tabs by topics, and then as you browse, it will automatically add new tabs into these, like, I don't know, macro tabs. I didn't get the terminology, but...
I don't know why you think this is for me. As I discussed the thing last episode when we talked about the rumor of this feature, I don't think I would ever use this feature. I got to manually arrange everything. But
I know you wouldn't, but you have so many friggin' tabs.
Yeah, maybe it's just for other people if it works well. We'll see. It depends on how they implement it. If they implement it in an automated way that it just happens to people, and it'll drive some people nuts where they'll say, why does it keep rearranging my tabs? And everyone has to go and learn how to turn it off. Or it will satisfy some people. We'll see.
Right. Safari lets you, will let you automatically monitor a page with a new feature called Notify Me. As someone who, as part of my container or my collection O containers, I run this thing called changedetection.io, which there is a hosted version, but there is also a version you can run in a container. And what this basically does is it lets you monitor web pages that perhaps don't emit RSS feeds or whatever the case may be. It'll let you monitor for like things being available for sale that weren't before. Their marketing website is pretty crappy, but I'll put a link in the show notes. This is an incredibly useful tool for me. I think we talked about way back when that the reason I got a Unify Travel Router, which by the way is what I'm talking to you through right now, is because I had this thing checking like every 60 seconds on Unify's website to see if it was available or not. Anyways, that is now a part of Safari, or if you squint anyway, it's a part of Safari with their Notify Me feature.
So does Safari have to be running? You have to have a Mac that's not asleep? Or maybe it works in sleep. Like that's.
I would assume so. Yeah, I think so.
And you bring this up, Casey. I think I talked to you about this a couple weeks ago because I wanted to do something similar. I ended up just vibe coding something. I was checking the menu of a local sandwich place to see if their specials included the sandwich that I like that they rarely put on special.
This is big Casey energy right here, and I'm so proud of you.
They have a special which is an egg salad BLT, which I thought should have been on the menu. Thought it should be on their menu all the time, and it's not a food that I have a lot. Like, they put it on their menu, like, once every couple months. But anyway, I kept missing it, so I'm like, I'm just going to set up a monitor for this, and I declined your Docker container, and I was going to vibe code it myself. But, of course, they had switched to some third-party menu provider that it's like a single-page web app where the actual rendered page has, like, two tags in it, and it's all JavaScript-generated. Yep. And so I had to find their back-end JSON thing, but their back-end JSON thing is authenticated, so I had to find a way to fake the authentication so I could get an authenticated request for their JSON back-end. And it worked, and it told me when the egg salad BLT was available, and I bought it recently, and it was disappointing. And so I disabled it. Somehow the egg salad was bad. I don't know if they put too much dill in it or something, but I was really disappointed. So I took off my monitoring. But anyway, this is obviously I think if more people knew about this, like if it wasn't just nerds like vibe coding something or using a Docker container or going to change detection.io, I think this could be useful for people. But I do wonder if it's going to require them to keep their Macs from going to sleep.
That is fair. And possibly the scariest thing that I saw the entire keynote, and the internet was all over this, passwords, the app can automatically fix, websites that have been compromised or where you've used the same password multiple times. That is incredible and also very scary. But I think it's the right idea. I mean, I applaud them going down that road. I don't think I would ever use it, but that's
I think
me.
The only way they can do that, like the passwords app has supported since its introduction, I think all of the various .well-known URLs. Where there's RFCs for this, where it's like if you have a website and you have a password system, you should support these endpoints, even if they just redirect. And it's like /.well-known/... where it's like change password, set password, blah blah blah. And I think most sites just implement as redirects. But the point is, a lot of sites don't implement that at all. And I think the passwords app can only help you with websites that support these well-known URLs. I'm not sure because I just saw a keynote, so we'll find out when this thing ships. But I would be terrified if passwords just tried to do it for any old website, because if you've ever gone to any old website and tried to change your password, as a human, it's hard to figure out how to do it a lot of the times. So I'd have very little, because what they would present to you is, hey, you have five passwords that suck. Do you want to fix all five? And you hit one button and then magic happens and it updates your passwords on five websites. As a human, me updating five bad passwords on five websites takes me a long time and is frustrating. I don't think a machine can do it unless they all support those .well-known URLs.
Yep. Let's see what else. They talked about how Calendar will have Fantastic House style natural language input, which I am very much here for. I think that's great.
But it already had that which was interesting. I mean,
but
I guess
now it won't very suck bad. As bad.
Right.
Yeah, that's the thing. It did, but it was very bad. They said that when you are in the phone app and if you are calling a business, and I'm not clear how they know any of these things, but they will try to surface like relevant information. So the example they gave is, hey, I'm calling, let's say, Delta to change a flight. Siri will surface your most recent flight information, including like a confirmation number or whatever.
Or it will surface the wrong flight information if you have multiple flights and this is the most recent email. This is the danger of these agents of giving you just-in-time data. Like, I like that it's doing it, and in a demo, the most recent email complains your flight number. But what if you've scheduled a bunch of different flights and they're round trips and there's different flight numbers and you're on the phone and you're like, yeah, my flight is 12345 because that's what it says in the phone app, but it's totally wrong. It's not that flight. It may require you as a human to go to your mail app, find the mail, look at the information in the mail and say, is this the flight or is this my wife's ticket or is this the return flight? Demos.
Yep.
Who would ever have more than one flight information in their email thing? Now, setting aside whether, and we'll get to this maybe in the next episode, whether or not Siri can see your email, because what if you don't use the mail app?
That is very fair. They talked about the home app. Okay, sure. Like they said, one of the things that they'll do, which is cool if it works, but I'm very skeptical that the crap home app and the crap Siri put together will somehow be a polished diamond. But here we go. They said that they will basically coalesce disparate notifications. So like, you know, Michaela crossed into the driveway, went to the front door, walked in the front door was open, the front door was closed. That is all coalesced into like Michaela came home. You know, or something along those lines. You get the idea.
The Google apps do this already. They do it themselves by just sending a single notification with a summary in it. But it seemed like the feature they were... I can't tell if the feature they were describing is that, hey, we'll take arbitrary apps notifications and then summarize them and condense them into one. Or were they saying, now the home app acts more like the Google app in that it will not send 25 notifications. It will coalesce them and send one notification with a summary.
That's a subtle difference, but you are right, and I'm not sure which one it is. It also said that they would basically do they would put together clips from compatible cameras, is what they said, to like make one event out of multiple perspectives. And then, speaking of the whole internet lost their minds about a raccoon. I think I was looking down and typing, so I missed what happened. What the heck is this about?
So someone delivers a fruit basket to a house and is caught on camera from seven different angles and said, Robert arrived and saved your fruit basket. So I guess it did facial recognition or whatever. Uh-huh. And so it was a fruit basket, and then he puts the fruit basket on the table, and then what I presume is a stunt raccoon. Or as many people said, an AI-generated raccoon, but it looked real to me, but who can tell? A raccoon in the middle of the day, probably has rabies, comes up and crawls onto the table and gets at the fruit basket. So
immediately, by the way, like with no delay.
And the raccoon was already there waiting. Again, raccoons generally shouldn't be out and active during the day, and if they are, you should stay away from them, but I wouldn't eat that fruit.
Also, like, I didn't quite know, like, I was expecting the summarized, you know, the summary of it to then be updated to say, and then a raccoon came on the table or something, but it didn't. So it kind of made the feature look bad, I think.
Yeah, I think they were saying that the notification, like the same notification, would update and show different content as new things happened, which I think would be something new because the Google app can't do that. The Google app just sends you a notification that says three people walk dogs in front of your house or something, right? But yeah, maybe they just didn't fit that into the demo. The stunt raccoon is probably not a thing that will come up in your life.
Probably not. But for what it's worth, Marco, one of the things they specifically did say was that I guess that answers John's question. They said that as new notifications arrive, it will update the coalesced notification with new information. And to your point, I guess it didn't happen in this case. Cameras finally get 4K resolution. Excuse me. HomeKit cameras can now, or HomeKit Secure Video can now do 4K. What they did, the thing that everyone knew that they would, natural language description to create shortcuts. They talked about Image Playground, and basically this is all stuff that I don't care about, except that you can now use photorealistic output for the first time. Remember, everything used to be very cartoony deliberately.
Now it just looks like what everyone thinks of as AI-generated imagery. Yep. Like they did the little sample they showed you of like a bunch of thumbnails. You're right that they do look more photoreal than the intentionally cartoony ones used to, but they all kind of look a little AI. Like this was the part where they put like the birthday person in an outfit and put candles on the cake and stuff, right? Was that the section? Anyway, I just, the novelty value of AI generated imagery has not had particularly amazing staying power, especially since the models are still producing imagery that people are currently able to detect as having been AI generated. If and when they surpass that and people can't tell anymore, I feel like the stigma will leave a little bit. But right now, I think there is kind of a stigma. If you were to AI generate an image and send it to somebody, you're better off sending them a terrible low-resolution meme from 1997 than you are AI generating a pristine photorealistic version of grandma on a skateboard on the half pipe, like the little thing they said. Like, the amusement value of that, I feel like, is already diminishing culturally. But I think the upshot of this section is image playground, the images no longer suck. Yep, that's what it comes down to. Because image generation, Apple was massively behind, and their new image generator is no longer embarrassingly behind. You can actually generate imagery that looks like middle-of-the-road image generation from any of the contemporary products in this Apple demo. We'll see how it does. But again, if people want to generate an image, are they going to launch Image Playground if they know it exists? If they know that it's here on their Mac?
That's the thing. Like, is anybody going to actually use this stuff?
No. Well, for the people who are currently generating AI-generated images because they amuse them, whatever image generator they're already using, I don't feel like this is going to displace them.
All right, so then they did the photos section. You can enhance images in ways that respect the original moment, they said, word for word. You can clean up, you can extend, so you can add space around the image. Pretty much everyone has a story about how they wanted to, including you, John. I feel like you've talked about this several times.
I've been using other apps to do this for years. It is very useful, especially for doing wallpapers, like because your phone is really tall, and I didn't want like my family's faces to be covered by the clock, right? So I would always add stuff. And there's tons of apps to do this. Again, I usually use Pixelmator or sometimes I use Photoshop or whatever. But yes, this is a feature they should add to photos. I think it's a huge thumbs up. The extend feature is great for being able to add a little background where you need it.
Yeah, and then you can also reframe, and you can do a spatial reframing, which I think as a technological case study or like as an engineering case study, this is so freaking cool. And I know that the people who are better photographers than me, which is almost everyone, took some issue with this, and I will let you talk about that in just a second. But I think this is incredible. So what you do is you take a photo, and it doesn't have to be captured with an Apple device. It can be just a regular photo from like my Olympus Micro Four Thirds camera. And it will compute and figure out the depth that was captured in that photo. And you can basically move around, drag the photo around to reposition where the person taking the picture was within this 3D space. I bet you this is not going to work near as well as it looked on the keynote, but what they showed on the keynote was incredible. And I really also liked that as you're dragging around and repositioning things during the interactive part of it, the areas that generative fill would fill in are kind of like a whitish blur. And so they're not like computing it, of course, as you're moving things around, but you're getting a very clear indication of how much of this image is about to be blurred. I think this is incredible if it even close to works. However, I do completely understand everyone's complaints about this, which I will let either one of you, I guess, John, perhaps take over why this is upsetting to people.
Well, it being upsetting to people is just like, oh, don't take your photos and like AI generate stuff on them and just like let the photos be what they are. But here's my take on it, which is, I guess, perhaps even more cynical. And that is that no feature can make people care about framing photos. That's my take. Like the idea that people can look at a photo and detect in any way that it is poorly framed, I think is false. I know this from every other person who's not a photographer in my life. They take photos that are incredibly poorly framed and they do not care. Not only do they not care, they can't tell. They can't distinguish a well-framed photo from a not well-framed one. They don't care that their photos are badly framed. They don't care that people have a pole coming out of their head. They don't care that it's 98% background that no one cares about. They don't care that it's shot up at an unflattering angle. Like, for the exception of like people taking selfies where they're trying to make themselves look hot or whatever, for the most part, when people take pictures in groups, I cannot convince anybody in my life to care how photos are framed. Now, it's great that this picture says, like, oh, let you reframe it, like you said, Casey, like, virtually change where the person might have been standing so that the pole isn't coming out of the top of their head, because if you took it from 2 feet to the left, the pole would be off to the side of them. But just getting people to understand that it's bad to have a pole coming out of your head in the picture is insane. Now, you know what the main thing that can make your pictures better with respect to framing is? It's called cropping, and it has existed for the life of the iPhone. Nobody does it. because they do not know that their pictures are poorly framed. Cropping is the number one thing you can do to your picture. If you actually got it too close, that you can extend now, so that's a cool AI feature. But most of the time, people make the opposite mistake. There's too much background, you're not centered, the camera is tilted, blah, 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 and people don't care. So I think extend is the best feature here, cleanup is the second best, reframe is a little bit silly and is going to make people ruin their pictures a little bit. But here's the thing. Because people don't care about how pictures are framed, if you show them that, they're like, oh, that's cool. And if I think about it for 2 seconds, they'd be like, well, how does it even do that? But I don't see them driven to use the feature because, like, it's not solving a problem they have. They're like, well, it's neat that you can do that. And I get how it's kind of, like, amazing and future-y because how does it know what's behind my head? They can't see it. Oh, it's making it up with the computer. That's amazing. But the question they would ask is, but why would I ever want to do this? I can already crop. I can already extend. I could see why I might want to use those if I ever wanted to touch my photos at all. So, yeah, I think reframe, I know they're excited about it and it's the coolest tech, but I think cleanup and extend are the highlight features.
I think this raises some interesting questions that we've been fighting as an industry for a long time now of, like, what is a photo? Is it cheating? Is it misleading? Is it fake? I think everybody draws that line in a little bit different place. Apple so far, I think, has done a pretty good job of finding that balance with their feature set that they've chosen. You know, the idea.
And by the way, I would say Apple, one of the things Apple does really well here is all of their edits are non-destructive. So you can always revert to original. And that provides a level of surety about what the real photo is versus the edited that lots of other applications don't provide.
Absolutely. Yeah, but, you know, I think, like, where I come down on it, which I think is basically where Apple comes down on it, is, like, I don't think it's great to have tools that can make photorealistic images of things that didn't really happen and pass them off as things that did happen. To be able to edit your photos to create a moment that really didn't exist and was pretty far from existing, I think that is, you know, questionable and tricky. But, like, if you are using editing, whether it's AI or older methods like, you know, photoshopping and tweaking colors and stuff like that, like, if you're using editing to create a misleading picture, that's morally questionable and that's a problem. But if you're using editing to make the image that you were trying to capture better, but it's still... it's still depicting a moment that occurred, and these tools are just helping you depict that moment better, I think that's generally fine. Now, again, everyone draws that line in different ways. To some people, like, adjusting the color and contrast of an image would be misleading and creating a fake scene that never really existed. To some people, using tools like the, you know, where it extends like this, where, like, you're creating entire parts of a scene that not only weren't in the frame, but might not actually exist in real life that way. Some people think that is over the line. Some people think that, like, it's fine to delete a trash can in the background or a person who was walking in the background that is not really your subject. Some people think that's wrong. I think I generally land where Apple lands with this. And I think they have found a good balance so far of the tools they have offered in photos editing to generally maximize, like, the value to the person without too much fraud.
Yeah. So I think that's basically it in terms of features. There's a few more things to talk about, of course, but any other features we want to discuss before I move on?
I'm really excited to get into all these OSs and just start using them. Because, like, all those giant word cloud slides they had this time, it really does seem like they had a really great goal in mind here of, tackle every small thing. Find a bunch of small stuff and tackle it. I love that idea. And then I hope also that all of these new APIs that we've gotten for all the new AI stuff, I hope this enables a lot of cool little improvements in apps. I think it can. We will see. You know, the first generation foundation models enabled a little bit of fun stuff. Not a ton. Let's see what the second generation can do. There's still a bunch of limits because they're still on device. The better models still only run on, as I mentioned earlier, like a pretty small number of pretty recent devices. So that could be a question mark for a while, but I actually like that there's a whole bunch of little improvements and some pretty interesting API improvements for us to play with. But as we were talking about last week about, like, you know, reward versus homework, basically, it seems like the homework side of it this year is pretty small. That's awesome, because that gives all of us now the ability to do to our apps what it seemed like Apple was focusing on their apps through the last year, which is make things better. Just overall, just a building year. That's really nice.
You tricked Marco into giving his final judgment again, but we're still going to do it. One more thing about the Apple Intelligence things, which they gave vague answers about, and they had more stuff later, which is usage limits. This is a question a lot of people had going into
We
got to discuss it in the preview thing, which is, do you have to pay money for this stuff? Because historically speaking, lots of the LLM-powered stuff that we do, especially at the cutting edge, costs money. There's a free version of it, but the free version is not as good as the one you pay for. Is Apple going to charge money for some of these things? And here's what they had to say about that. They said not the exact words, that daily usage limits apply to some features. This is a direct quote from Apple, like from the press release. Some Apple Intelligence features, including image generation, have daily usage limits because they rely on powerful server models. Increased access is available with most iCloud Plus subscription plans, which also include Apple Intelligence support for compatible home cameras. So this is super vague, and this is really kind of an inversion of the industry standard for the past several years, which has been, hey, we have a new subscription for you to pay for, or we've increased the price of your subscription. But guess what? The new subscription or the increased price of the subscription, it comes with these AI features that you didn't ask for. Apple's doing the opposite. You're already paying for iCloud Plus? Well, guess what? If you're already paying for it, we increase your usage limits on a thing that you didn't have before, which is the ability to use our powerful server models to do image generation. The bottom line is that a lot of these features that were shown here that are not running on device cost Apple money to run. And it's always the question of, like, well, shouldn't Apple just eat that cost and we get it all for free? And at a certain point, even Apple can't eat it anymore. I mean, what do you expect, more than 5 gigs of free iCloud storage? No. So now they're going to be running inference for you for free on their/Google servers up to a point. And we talked about, like the iWork apps had those ridiculous limits where you could do, like, make 2 slide decks and your usage was up. So we'll see what the limits are. We'll see where the rubber meets the road. But I do like the idea of them saying, some of you are already paying us a subscription. You'll get more stuff because you're already paying us. And I don't think they didn't announce anything that said, oh, and by the way, all your subscriptions are going up to account for the AI features that you may never use. So far, they haven't said that. All they said is, if you pay us, your limits will be higher. I give that a thumbs up. And in general, the economic reality of, oh, so you want to do cutting edge stuff with LLMs? Well, it turns out that costs money because someone's got to pay it. And right now we're all sort of gliding on VCs paying for a lot of it for us because these companies just get investor money and charge people to use it. But the price they're charging is not yet potentially paying for what it costs to give out because they're still in that growth phase. I'm not sure where Apple is on the spectrum. Like, obviously we've gone over that they have not spent the hundreds of billion dollars that everyone else does. But those servers and those data centers aren't free. Someone's got to be paying for that. And somehow that cost has to be paid by margins on Apple devices, by existing iCloud Plus subscriptions. This will be a tricky balance. And hours after the keynote, I don't know where they're going to land. Their statement is very vague. But in case you were wondering, someone is going to be paying something for some things. It's not all free.
Also, there's a different side of the cost situation here, which is developers, it seems like, now have access in certain APIs to the private cloud compute models, but they said there's, like, if you get the first 2 million installs of your app, you don't pay up to a certain rate, and then they just didn't say what happens after that.
There's been APIs like that. Like, a lot of the CloudKit ones are like that too, where, like, yeah, oh, up weather, to a certain limit, it's all free.
Yeah, like, weather works that way too. I mean, and there's and they also said somewhere around, like, you know, for iCloud Plus subscribers, they get higher limits, but is that for you and your app too? It seems like it might have been. So I think this is going to be a pretty weird and complicated pricing situation for developers for a little while. I would never make an app based on the assumption that I would stay under that cap forever. I would always have that in the back of my mind. Like, what happens when I cross that if I cross that 2 million installations mark? What happens to my cost model that I've made this app based on?
The way Apple has done it with their other APIs, though, is, well, I'm not sure about the WeatherWare API, but the CloudKit ones, that doesn't that get charged against the user? Like, it's their iCloud account that they would have to upgrade if they want to use it more?
CloudKit does, but Weather doesn't. So yeah. There's a bunch
so
of
which
like,
is this
little...
more like? Is it more like CloudKit or is it more like the Weather?
I think it's going to be more like the Weather, but they haven't really given a full, and who knows, yeah. When they're going to announce full pricing, probably not for at least a little while, but...
And the weird thing about pricing about these services, like the things we mentioned, the Weather API and CloudKit and stuff, I don't think there's been a lot of motion in the limits and the cost structure. Whereas charging for charging for AI inference, that's not a static pricing landscape in 2026. Like it has already changed and it is going to, because we get better at doing inference, but then the models get bigger. Like it's not the type of thing that Apple can set in stone in 2026 and just say, we're never going to change this pricing structure, because that is so out of touch with where we are with this technology. It's changing from day to day, moment to moment. Like who knows where this will go? It could go massively up, could go massively down. The bubble could burst and everything could go up a huge price. So there could be a breakthrough in inference and everything gets cheaper. Like who could have predicted all the RAM and SSD prices? Like this is not an area where Apple can say, here's the pricing structure and then just never revisit it. I mean, they could, but it would be a terrible idea. So please, Apple, don't do that.
Please, Hammer, don't hurt him. Also, there was a couple of mentions in the keynote and then later a document on Apple's newsroom. And it says, in this document, due to the Digital Markets Act, or DMA, Apple will not be able to ship Siri AI in the European Union with the release of iOS 27 and iPadOS 27. Over the past several months, EU regulators did not accept any of Apple's proposed solutions to bring Siri AI to the EU while safely supporting other virtual assistants. Quote, we're deeply disappointed that our EU users won't have Siri AI on iPhone or iPad when we share our new software releases later this year, quote, said Craig Federighi, Apple's Senior Vice President of Software Engineering. Quote, our hope is to eventually bring Siri AI to the EU, and we will continue to engage with EU regulators on a path forward. However, their refusal to engage constructively on solutions that preserve privacy and security means we do not currently have a timeline for Siri AI's availability on iOS and iPadOS in the EU, quote.
I don't know if there was another press release for China, but they did mention in the keynote, also, we don't know how this is going to work in China, and it won't be available there until we work something out with the Chinese government, so... This is not really any news. Apple continues to fight with the EU about all things related to its platform.
Yep, I do think it was quite funny. I don't know. It's hard for me to have a reasonable and unbiased opinion about this because I am. I think I've been described in the past as the most American, which is not something I'm proud of these days. But nevertheless, I don't know. I do think this is funny, if nothing else, because it's two, unstoppable forces, approaching each other. And I don't know. I don't feel like anyone's winning.
Yeah, and this is like a lot of the past issues. Like Apple theoretically has a point, which is to allow third party LLMs to have the same access that our LLM has would be a security concern on the phone. But then the EU's point is, yeah, that's the whole point of the thing. Whatever access you have, other companies should give access to it because it's anti-competitive. If only you can do the fancy things on your phone, how is anyone ever going to compete with Siri on your phone? Like this becomes not an avenue for competition because of your stranglehold on the market. Like, and that's where they meet each other. They butt heads, which is like, okay, the EU wants competition. And Apple says, yeah, but A, we don't want competition. We're not going to say that, but we don't want competition. And B, it's difficult for us to figure out how to give competition because we, as the platform owner, have such incredibly invasive access to everything. And we trust ourselves because we're trustworthy, but we don't trust these other companies. And right. As a consumer, you can like, well, I kind of get where they're coming from because I wouldn't want, Facebook to have unfettered LLM access to my phone to read all my information and do anything they want. But on the other hand, I also don't want the iOS and Apple platform landscape to always be limited by whatever idea Apple has about something. So Apple says, well, we came up with a solution. We came up with this trusted platform thing or whatever. And it's just kind of like the different browser engines. Like, we came up with a secure way for people to compete with us. And that is just a way, not just a way, but that is also a way for Apple to have a little knob that says, oh, if the competition gets too tight, just turn this knob. Because we control everything that we control the way third parties access the stuff that we let them access, and we control how much they access, and we control what they have to do, and we approve their apps, and we're going to force them to jump through all these hoops and, like the third party stores. We'll make it so onerous that no one will ever want to compete with us. That's the cynical take. And the other take is, but on the other hand, you don't want those things to have complete access to the phone. So, no one is completely in the right here. Both parties have difficulty. I mean, the EU is trying to do the right thing, but not understanding the constraints, and Apple is trying to maintain control while also complying with the law, and they're failing to do that. The people who set the law say you are not complying with it, and Apple can disagree, but Apple doesn't make the laws. So this is kind of a bummer for the EU, and I'm not sure what the China situation is there, but it's probably even more grim, and that, you know, maybe they want Chinese LLMs to have access to the phone to the same degree that Apple does. Yeah, it's not a good situation. It's just a repeat of all the other things we've had, and the upshot is people in the EU don't get these features. So folks in the EU will try it out for you and tell you if it sucks or not.
I think that's mostly it. As we mentioned earlier, there was no Turnus. And then at the very, very end, Tim had his personal note where he just basically said the things you would expect him to say. And then there was a music video at the very, very end, but we're going to talk about that in the after show. Anything else before we wrap on WWDC 2026?
I thought that the Tim goodbye thing at the end was the perfect encapsulation because, first of all, like, you know, Apple, we all know that Apple is, you know, that they release new phones in September and that the OSs are announced, or the OSs ship, you know, right before that, like a week before that. We know that. But Apple won't even say it. They won't say it in the video, ships in September. No, they said ships in the fall. You know, everyone knows when it ships, but they won't say it. Everyone knows at this point. You can see, like, we'll talk about it in a little bit in overtime. There's probably a foldable iPhone coming up, you know, but Apple won't say it. They pretend like it's still a big secret, and they uphold the secret. And that's how they are with a lot of things. In this case, I think Apple is pretending that this is not Tim Cook's last event officially, like in hosting. But everybody, and I think the only reason they would pretend that way is because they don't like to transmit their future plans. They don't like to say, look, we all know that even though we announced John Turnus was going to be CEO on September 1st, we all know that the next event is probably going to be like a week after that. So they won't say that. Even though, again, everyone knows it. It's the pattern they've kept for years.
Well, I think you just called out the distinction here. The difference about saying when the event is because that's unannounced. They want to keep their options open. Why would you commit to something when you're not sure whether you're going to hit that deadline? Who knows what could happen between now and September? Whereas the CEO transition, they did commit to a date. They wrote it in the press release. There's an exact day. And so it's two different things there. I think the main reason they didn't talk about the transition, even though it has been 100% announced, is because it would distract from the announcement. Like, but if Tim Cook had said anything, if he had done a big heartfelt, this is my last thing, and I can't believe this is the last time I'm ever going to talk to you, and blah, 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 there would be stories about that. And by being Tim Cook and saying a word salad that doesn't say anything significant, he's sure that there's not going to be a separate story about his statement at the end of the presentation. And so far, I haven't seen one.
But it's
impossible to write about.
Well, yeah. But by them not being willing to just come out and say, yeah, we know that you know that this is Tim's last event. We're not going to say that. Everyone knows it, including Tim and all of us, but we won't actually say it. And then what we will say is, you know, as you said, standard Tim Cook fare. It's vaguely pleasant and fairly content-free, but
word salad.
Yeah, I respect what he was trying to do. The iconography of him standing below the giant rainbow at Apple Park, while he has massively kissed up to the Trump regime that has fought against queer rights at every single turn and continues to do so during Pride Month at that. I think that was a perfect encapsulation of the end of Tim Cook's reign.
Yep, I think you're right. All right, well, thank you for sticking with us for WWDC 2026. We still have an after show and overtime to come, but I'm excited. I know we've already done our closing remarks like thrice, so I will just say I'm excited.
I haven't done mine once yet.
All right, John, close it up for us.
It up. All right.
I did go ahead at the beginning. I basically gave the summary version, but I'll just re-wrap it up here because we're at the end. The reason I was so excited about everything that was shown here is because every single thing that they announced make something better. And I know that's a low bar, but it reminds me of the scene that I think I've brought up on this very show in the past from the movie American History X, where the main character, who is a skinhead white supremacist Nazi kind of guy, is, I think he's in jail at this point, and something terrible happens to him in jail, and he's in a hospital bed, and like this guy's talking to him as like his advisor or whatever, and it's like he's hit rock bottom. He's at his lowest point. He's a skinhead. He committed crimes. He's in jail. He's having a terrible experience in jail. He's still unrepentantly racist and terrible. And this like his mentor or guide or whatever, his black friend, is trying to convince him, hey, don't be a Nazi. It sucks. And so he's on the hospital bed, and the guy says to him, has anything you've done made your life better? Which is the exact right time to propose that question to this person, to sort of get some perspective and see clarity. And I feel like the last WWDC, part of the reason I was so upset about macOS 26 in particular, but a lot of the 26OS things, is I didn't feel like they were making things better. They made a bunch of stuff worse for no good reason. And it's not so much the things they made worse, like broke the world, oh, it's unusable, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't that bad. It was fine. Like, you could get around with it. But, like, the idea that they would spend an entire year working on something that did not make their OSs better pained me at my core. And so this WWDC, pretty much every single thing they announced makes their products better, assuming it works the way they say it does. But there's nothing I saw that was like, oh, no, don't do that. That will make your products worse. Now, they were helped by making things so much worse last year that merely improving on that, not even getting back to where they were before, but merely fixing some of the problems from last year, does count as making something better, even if the state that it exists in the 26OS is still isn't as good as it was in iOS 16 or 17 or something. But it's the trend. Like, that's the thing when people complain to me, oh, you hate these OSs so much or whatever. They're not that bad. They're fine. You can use them. I've said this from day one. It's not actually that bad. The upsetting thing is the direction. Directionally, it is upsetting to see people intentionally using bad ideas to make things worse. And pretty much every single thing in this keynote was using good ideas to make things better by small amounts. And possibly they won't work the way they were shown or whatever, but at least everything they were showing was good. And there's a lot of it, as we noted. The word clouds, all the big list of things that they're doing. Like, they didn't even have time to put it all in. There's so much stuff. All these little things. All the things that get the applause lines. I mean, all the things where Casey's writing in the notes, like, hell yes to caching on async images. Like, developer stuff, they're like, yes, finally, I've always wanted that API. I've always wanted that capability. I've always wanted to add keywords on my phone to the Photos app. I always wanted to be able to extend the frame and not use a third-party app. Every single thing in this keynote is making something better. That's boring for people. But where's my foldable phone? Where's my VR headset? Where's my, you know, M5 Mac Studio, right? I get it. I get it why people are not excited by this.
This fall, we already shipped it. You didn't like it. And probably next year.
Yeah. But like... But just, man, I love – that's why I'm excited about this. I love that everything I'm seeing. And as I go look for more stuff, watch some sessions, learn about this, look at the documentation. I'm like, that's better. That's going to be improved. That's going to be cool. And this is a very familiar feeling for me because that's what WWDC always used to be like. It's like whatever came before it, whatever they announced at WWDC and all the sessions and the keynotes and all that other stuff, it was like, let me tell you all the ways that things are going to be better. And boy, does that feel good after last year.
Yeah, that's really well put, John.
Well said. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Cloud. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the perks of ATP membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about some updates that are popping up about the foldable iPhone. We're going to be covering that in Overtime because we just couldn't cram it into this episode. Join now to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week. So, Casey, you're famous. This is amazing.
I don't know if I would go quite that far, but it was a very unusual end of the keynote. So I'm sitting there, and the state of the world for me was I was in the main living area of the house that we're staying in, and I was watching the keynote on the TV because I'm me. You know, I brought an ancient Apple TV with me, and I've had, you know, I'm watching the keynote on the TV. I'm typing out notes and on my laptop. And I'm starting to send a text to Aaron as Tim is up saying, hey, the three of them were at the beach. You know, maybe I can pop down for a little bit before the State of the Union. I think it's ending now.
You didn't right see my message before you left?
So right as I send that, all of a sudden, Tyler Stallman and Jason Snell both send me texts at like the exact same moment. Tyler's was 2 exclamation points and Jason's was call sheet in the keynote. And that's all I knew.
And, right, because they're seeing it like before you are, because they're there
because
and live,
they're like
right?
a minute to two before yeah. me, because they're in the audience. And I don't understand how this is possible. I assumed that I missed something.
Yeah, right.
Because
it's over to you.
Point, at this point, it's over. I just told Aaron, yeah. I'm going to come down to the beach.
I think I was like 10 seconds ahead of you, which is
you
why
were.
I knew
you
I
were.
Was. I knew I was seeing it before you did, so I immediately typed into the window so you would see it. But at that point, I think you'd already gotten up and left.
Yeah, usually
no,
the Apple TV stream is like you know 10 or 15 seconds behind the online stream, which itself is you know probably a good minute behind the in person stream.
I got the info from live people too. The reason I had it much faster than you is I got it from a live person.
Oh, okay.
So in any case, so I get out my phone and. I am so sad because I think Tyler said it to me, but I didn't notice until it was all over. Tyler sends the 2 exclamation points, to which I replied with an ellipsis and a question mark. And he sends a photo of the presentation. But at this point, of course, it had long since moved on. And so I see something like the screen is fairly far away from him. And I see that there's some gentleman and like a couple of like round wrecks on the screen. And Tyler asks, are you watching? And I said, I'm seeing Tim doing his wrap up, to which he said, but I didn't see this until after. Oh, keep watching, record it and your reaction, which I so deeply wish I'd seen that because that's what I should have done. But in the heat of the moment, as my heart rate is spiking, because I don't know what's about to happen, but apparently something's going down. I take out my phone and I record the TV because I don't know what else to do. Like in retrospect, I should have recorded myself, but whatever. And I record the TV and all of a sudden after Tim fades out, they have like appreciation by, was it Eric, the architect, I believe. And so there's this guy standing in what vaguely looks like an office-y kind of reception-y area. And he starts rapping. All I need is good reads and some better sleep. And you start seeing these app icons pop up. I keep it calm. So these drafts stay in call sheet. And
now, Casey, can you put drafts in call sheet?
Well, not Greg Pierce's drafts, no. But I don't fucking care because this was one of the coolest things I have had happen to me in a fairly long time. Because there, on the Apple keynote, admittedly after it was kind of sort of over, but on the Apple keynote is Jelly's icon for call sheet floating in space and approaching the camera a little bit, or I guess the camera was approaching it. Which I didn't even know what to do with myself. You know, I'm like, my heart is racing. At this point, my phone is fucking exploding. Beep. I am getting text messages from any vague Apple person in my life. Like if you are even vaguely aware of Apple enough to watch the keynote, every one of them sent me a text and they were all very kind and very excited. It was so, so wonderful. And I'm trying to process this all. Meanwhile, I'm calling Erin and she's on the beach. As far as she knows, I'm about to walk down to the beach potentially. And I said, call sheet was in the keynote. And she was like, wait, what? I don't remember what words I said to her, but I would presume that approximately none of them made any sense. And I'm not going to put her on the spot and get her on the mic because that would be way too awkward. But suffice to say, I think I made almost no sense. And she's like, well, just stay there and handle whatever's going on there, and we were actually probably going to come up anyway, so we'll be up in a few minutes. And so I get through all my text messages, and then I look at Indigo, which is, you know, my multi-platform app that I'm using these days, and my mentions are a dumpster fire, but for the first time in a long time in a good way, which was a welcome change. So this was extremely cool and extremely unexpected, and I think perhaps the funniest bit of this whole thing, leaving aside the fact that we were not given the nod for the keynote, and yet here I am in the keynote, but whatever, or we were not given the nod to attend WWDC, but here my app is in the keynote. But beyond that, Jelly zoomed in a little bit, and Jelly noticed that the version of the icon they used is the one that actually has the Hunt for Red October on it, and John McTiernan and the release date and so on. At one point, like a year and a half ago, Apple had reached out to me and it said in so many words, do you have rights for this? And like, or like, is this kosher? And I was like, I don't know. So I had Jelly whip together an alternative version. They never asked me why. And I actually don't think it related to this. They never asked me why they wanted this information, but I said, well, you know, I'm not sure if it's 100% on the up and up to me. And I forget how I phrased it, but I'm not sure it's 100% on the up and up, but here's a different version of it. And I think off the top of my head, it's like the hunt or the search for Blue October with the director listed as K, K-A-Y, Celis, C-E-L-I-S, which was 100% Jelly. It was incredible. So it's directed by K-Celis. And anyways, and so I think that might even be the default app icon now. I haven't thought about icons in a while. But they had this alternative, completely fabricated version. The one that they used in the keynote video says Hunt for October by John McTiernan, which I think is hilarious.
Love that.
But anyways, this was a completely surreal experience. I'm still not entirely sure what to make of it. And like, you know, and because I'm me, in the one moment I'm like, man, I really did make it. I really did it. Look at, I really, you know, Joe, we did it, which is what I said to Jelly. You know, Joe, we did it. We did it. But then 10 seconds later, I'm like, oh, they just needed the right thing to rhyme with drafts or to rhyme with whatever.
I thought you were going to say, well, where's the call to action? Can people tap on that to buy my thing? This is great, exactly. And all, but is it going to turn into sales?
Probably not. But it's so funny that I, you know, my natural inclination is to just go from better sleep and call sheet, I guess, were vaguely rhymey, and I'm assuming that that's why they used my app, is not because they feel like it's good or anything like that, or they enjoyed the icon. It's just, oh, we needed something to rhyme with better sleep.
No, they think it's good. Like there are lots of apps in the App Store that honestly would have been a closer rhyme,
right?
So, no, just take this for what it is. It's cool. It's an honor, and enjoy it.
I mean, your app has been featured, right?
Yeah. Well,
I'm assuming they were pulling from the apps that they had already editorially determined that are apps they like.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
But it was wild, to say the least. I'm very appreciative and very thankful. Now, the other thing I noticed later on after I, like, watched it for the 18th time, toward the end of this, like, music video thing, what is it? Eric, the architect, I think is the gentleman's name, is standing in a room and is holding what appear to be like 1 foot by 1 foot, like printouts, if you will, of these app icons. And it's kind of like throwing them in, you know, and whatever. Let me be clear. I don't know that they ever printed one for call sheet. I never saw like one of these physical objects. For all I know, maybe it was CGI anyway. If this exists, I will give a testicle to have this in my house. Like, I will do whatever it takes.
I mean, you
can
probably get one made.
Yes, but that's not the same.
It's not the real one. It's like replicating the one from the video. It's not the object itself is not the thing. It's its provenance that's important.
It's exactly it. Well put.
And like, yeah, and I would assume they're composited, but it would be really cool if they weren't.
So yep, exactly.
No,
right.
I think they printed. So I think that, I mean, obviously most of them are CG, but I think they probably had physical ones too.
Yeah, well, again, I don't...
But yours was one of the ones that I only saw in CG.
Exactly right.
Although we should look at that big pile to see if Grok is in that pile on the floor.
And we should also
Speaking of trust and safety, we forgot to mention that trust and safety section. Oh, they're all as big about safety for children, except when it comes to potentially banning Elon Musk's app that is used to take clothes off children.
Yeah, it's something else. But also in the video, we mentioned, you know, Greg Pearson Drafts, Curtis and Slopes was in it. And I feel like some of our other friends were in there at some point. But it was so wild and so cool. And we'll put a link to the music video in the show notes. It comes at the very, very end of the keynote after Tim's, you know, outro or what have you. But I am so, you know, it's one of those pinch yourself moments. Like, did that just happen? Was that real? And it's very, very neat. And, you know, Craig Hockenberry, I'll try to dig up the toot for the show notes, but made a really interesting point, and it was meant in a really good way, which is exactly how I took it. But he said basically, like, you know, one of the fun things about WWDC in years past, like several years ago now, was the design awards, the Apple Design Awards. And it would be incredible because you would know, I feel like we knew the nominees, but we didn't know the winners before WWDC. And a lot of people would go to the actual award ceremony where you would learn who the winner was. And the camaraderie and the congratulations and all that, that used to be so pivotal and important. I mean, Marco, you've talked about wanting one for years.
Absolutely.
And that used to be so much more important than I feel like it is now, because now it's basically just a freaking email, and that's all it is. And Craig was lamenting that, and I think Craig is right. But what one of the points that Craig made was that this being in the keynote in any capacity is kind of what the ADA has become, or that same feeling you get, that we get that with our peers more from having like a flash in a keynote, because really ultimately in this like 2 hour keynote, the word call sheet being said once and my icon appearing on the screen for like 100 frames, like that's really not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things, but it was the coolest thing that's ever happened to me. So it is kind of a big deal.
But Craig is right. Like the combination, the formula you need to make that experience is, you need recognition from Apple, and you need your peers to witness it.
Yes, well put, well put.
The old in-person one was the recognition from Apple is they gave you the award. And your peers witness it because WWDC used to be in person, not just for a tiny select group of people who fit in Apple Park, but for like 5,000 people. I know it was still a tiny fraction of the developer base, although in the early years that actually wasn't the tiny fraction. But anyway, being in front of like 5,000 of your peers who care enough to buy an expensive plane ticket to San Francisco, they would get to witness you receiving your recognition from Apple. The venue for that now is not Apple Park because half the people that it's probably less than half that used to go to WWDC are there, and half of them are YouTube influencers who don't know who developers are anyway, right? They're just there because they think phones are cool. And they have no idea. Like, it's not just developer peers. Now it's mostly just, like, you know, mainstream press who are interested in Apple products, not so much interested in developer stuff. Whereas if you showed up, especially at, like, the ADAs weren't in the keynote back in the day, or at least a lot of the time they weren't in the keynote. They were a separate thing. Who was still there at WWDC? Who's going to go to the ADAs? It was developers. Like, a mainstream YouTube influencer or equivalent from back in the day was not going to go to the ADAs at all because they didn't care. So the only way you have to get any recognition in front of your peers is you have to be in the keynote. Because every developer around the world is watching the keynote, not just the ones who are there. People at Apple Park just see the same video we do. They just see it a little bit earlier, right? And so this is it. This is the only venue we have for you to be recognized by Apple in front of your peers.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt really freaking good. And I'm going to be riding this high for quite a while, I'm sure. And, you know, it felt pretty crummy not to get invited to WWDC. And I mean, I think we already talked about this on the show. We are more commonly not invited than we are invited. So it is not unexpected to not get the invite, but it hurts every time a little bit because I don't know, maybe I'm a child, maybe I'm just a person. I don't know, but it hurt a little bit, but this definitely turned that frown upside down and it is very cool. And I'm very, very appreciative. I don't know who at Apple made that happen, or I don't know if it was just that I got super lucky and Eric, the architect, just needed to make that weird rhyme, but one way or another, however it happened, I'm going to choose to believe that it was a subtle nod and a subtle thank you in my general direction, and that's what I'm going to go to bed
based
with.
On the lyrics, I don't think Eric the Architect knows what your app does, but I do think Apple presented him with a list of apps to incorporate into a rap song, and your app was among them because Apple likes your app.
Yeah, I sure hope so. But that wasn't the only video that happened today. There was posted to X or Twitter of all places, which really grosses me out. But Tim posted a video with a bunch of suggestions for how to open the keynote, which I kind of wanted to hate this because it's kind of silly and dumb in a bunch of ways, but I actually kind of liked it. So this is a bunch of random celebrities basically telling him how to say good morning, which was very, very funny to me.
It is so, to Marco's point he's made several times, it is such a Tim Cook thing that his catchphrase is literally good morning, because that's how he would open every keynote. And it's like looking for any sign of life or personality. It's like, well, you do say good morning every single time, and you do have an accent that some people find amusing. So you say good morning and his... whatever it is.
It's good morning.
Yeah. Good morning. I can't do it. Anyway, I think the interesting thing about this video, obviously this is like, you know, it's not a goodbye Tim video, but it is a Tim dedicated segment in what we know to be his last thing or whatever. Many, many celebrities appear in this video saying the word good morning. Many of them. How long have they been producing this video? A year? A year and a half before he announced his retirement? How do you get the time? Even though you just got to stick a camera in their face for 2 seconds and say good morning, there's a lot of celebrities. They have busy schedules. Just coordinating alone, we want to do a thing for Apple. Are you interested? Do you have time? It'll only take 30 seconds of your time. We might need a crew, blah, blah, blah. Multiply that by 15 A-list actors. This must have been in the works for a long time. I feel like this is a lot of effort for a pretty silly segment, and the only reason it exists is because this is Tim Cook's last keynote.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think it's more that Apple has a lot of connections to the celebrity world. You know, first through Apple Music, and then later through Apple TV Plus, which is now Apple TV on the Apple TV.
Sure, I'm not saying people would refuse to do it. Just logistically finding room in all of their calendars, it had to have taken 6 months.
What if they just like gave an intern a really big budget to go spend on Cameo?
Yeah, and no, but here's the thing. If you've ever seen real cameos, the lighting is terrible. Like, these were not that they were produced and they're in a studio, but they all looked okay. Some of them look really good, where I think they actually sent a crew. But cameos look like you can't even see anything, and they're blurry, and it's overly compressed, and they're like in their back room, and it's echoey. And these were all above that level.
Yeah, I don't know. I like I said, I wanted to hate it, but I thought it was kind of cute.
All right. And the other thing before we can't say this to the after show, even though, or can't say this overtime, even though overtime is about the foldable phone, but just to acknowledge a few of the things that these weren't in the keynote. And, you know, obviously there's tons of stuff that wasn't in the keynote, including the whole State of the Union that we'll get to in future episodes. But just in the people scrambling to notice things in the hours after the keynote aired, Vince on Mastodon was the first person who I saw that saw this. Vince says, of course, a tech note on optimizing AppKit for sidecar touch interfaces. Definitely not for touchscreen MacBooks. And this is TN3212, adopting gesture recognizer for sidecar touch support. And it reads in part, in macOS 27, AppKit continues to standardize on gesture recognizers as the primary mechanism for input handling. This change directly affects sidecar, which, by the way, is the thing where you use an iPad as your secondary screen on your Mac. Affects sidecar because gesture recognizers are the only way to respond to touch input from a sidecar-connected iPad running iPadOS 27. This article explains how the gesture recognizer model works and how to implement gesture recognizers correctly for sidecar touch input and how to update your existing event handling code and which APIs macOS 27 adds. Do you want to know how to add touch support to AppKit controls? Well, you know, for sidecar, like, obviously, like,
it's such,
you know,
a common use case. Obviously,
the iPad is a touch interface, and yes, you can use it as a second screen, but, you know, you can touch the screen on the iPad, and if you have like an AppKit app and you're someone's using a sidecar display, you might want to check out these new APIs we've added to AppKit for gesture recognition for sidecar.
Yeah, that's what it's for, obviously.
so that is one of the least subtle things I've ever seen. Well done, Apple, because I was like, how are they going to put that out? How are they going to even talk about that? Oh, yeah, sidecar.
I have a friend who has a problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Sam Henry Gold writes, iOS 26 framework references fold state and angle degrees, but I'm sure that's nothing.
Right, and Apple's put a lot of effort in WWDC this year is about resizable iPhone apps.
Why would they want to resize the simulator to make an iPhone app really wide? When would that come up?
I don't know.
We'll talk about that.
Interesting. And they showed in the demos, like, look, let me take this phone app, and they expand the phone app to be like twice as wide. I'm like, wow. I mean, like, I know some phones are wider than others, but really? Why would you ever make the simulator window twice as wide? And they show like it changing from a one column to a two column. Interesting. So, again, not particular. I mean, this is such a land of leaks. They used to have more of a lockdown in the days before, like, we're going to add, you know, we're going to make the iPhone 6 be wider, or we're going to add some height to it in the iPhone 5 or whatever. They had an easier time keeping secrets then. But, yeah, this is just from people downloading the SDK and, like, searching for things and finding fold state and angle degrees is really something in the SDKs. I mean, did they even need those symbols to go out? So, yeah, foldable iPhone coming. Stay tuned to Overtime for more on that, because as the title of the Overtime segment on note says, the foldable iPhone takes shape, literally.
Yeah, and then somebody pointed out that there was also a lot of talk about origami in the State of the Union.
Oh, yeah, their demo app was origami?
Yeah.
What was that? I mean, it was a mess. It's just a messaging app. It's just a name we pick. It's just a name.
For some reason, we're thinking about folding a lot.
So we didn't say it. No one said fold. Who said fold? I just said Oregon.
All right. Thank you for sticking with us live, people. And we will talk to you next week. Titles. Where is my thing?
We have good titles this week.
No hardware, no Turnus needs a comma.
I liked I Done Fixed It, which I suggested, but you had said, John.
Yeah, that's fine. Let me see what else we got.
I like All the Way to the Right. Let's see. I also
is dead.
Yeah, like Concentricity is dead. The light has moved. I thought that was fun.
Stunt Raccoon.
Let's see. I think I like All the Way to the Right. I think that's my number one.
What was that even about?
The slider. Liquid Glass slider.
Ugh, no, I don't like that.
I like I Done Fixed It. I like Boring But Refreshing.
I could do Boring But Refreshing. I like that too.
I suggested a different version of that. Oh, I suggested Not Boring or something like that. Not Boring But Refreshing, which I think I like it. I think I like the one that's currently got four votes most, which is not what I suggested, which is Boring But Refreshing.
Insightful and not negative. Do you remember that one?
Yep. I like Too Much Dill. That?
Too Much Dill is pretty good.
I don't think my egg salad complaints rise to the level of title. it's Road Trip.
That would be funny, actually.
But that, I mean, that probably was like a connected title, of, you know, 10 years ago, whenever that was.
Oh, yeah. I guarantee that was a title. I kind of like I Done Fixed It. Boring But Refreshing, I find boring and not refreshing.
Cool.
I kind of like the Crystal Pepsi of Aqua.
I could do that. I mean, that's fine.
I could do that. That's a very old man joke, but I could do it. I think I Done Fixed It is my favorite. I could do the Crystal Pepsi one, though.
I Fixed It and Crystal Pepsi are my two top two. What do you guys like?
I don't like I Done Fixed It. So.
All right, then we'll go Crystal
yeah.
Pepsi. All right, vamp for a second while I put this in the robot.
I'm surprised you remember Crystal Pepsi. Weren't you really young for that?
I never actually had Crystal Pepsi.
Oh, you just heard tell of it. You didn't live through
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Well, I think I was alive for it, but like I wasn't even allowed to have soda in my house growing up, so we wouldn't have had it anyway. Like I would have maybe seen it at a friend's house. But wasn't it available for a very short time?
Yeah, yeah. For mostly good reason, I think.
Yeah. All right, you don't have to vamp anymore. I'm going to have to come back and do the show notes.
Remember that like fruit punch that came in the accordion bottle? Remember that?
No.
It was like... Not like the instrument, the accordion, but like just like a bottle that would the whole gimmick was like you could collapse the bottle downwards.
Yeah, I think I remember
as
that.
I don't know.
You could make the thing smaller as the level of the drink went down.
Right. Which like why would you ever want to do that? Like
well,
that
it just takes up less room.
Yeah. Except what are you gonna put stuff on top of it? And also when you push it down, isn't it gonna make the drink splash out a little bit?
I think that was part of the fun. I think you could push it down and it would start squirting out.
Yeah, that was very heavily advertised on TV for like 2 years and then never saw it again. Anyway, all right. Thank you, bootleg people, or live people, rather. We're going to cut you off now and go to the bootleg for overtime. We have all sorts of ridiculous schedule changes in the months of June and July for various vacation reasons for all of us. So we'll see you sometime. Thanks for listening.
Yeah,
we're either Sunday or Monday next week.
Yeah, we're aiming for this coming Sunday evening. No promises. If that doesn't work out, we'll do a EU-friendly Monday morning recording, but we are aiming for Sunday evening.
Yes, Burple. Thank you, Jacques Huc in the chat. That was the drink. It was called Burple. That was it.
I'm glad with our long
See, you make it burp by squeezing
over.
It.
Exactly. Yeah, for some reason that didn't last. I don't know why. All right, bye, live people.
Burple drink, huh?